Welcome to X Squared Radio, first broadcast of 2013. So happy you could join us at our undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Tonight, we have a special guest for you. By the way, for those of you that are unfamiliar with X Squared Radio, this is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, as we launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Norlin Jacobs, those of you familiar with him know who he is. Screenwriter, film contributor, author, lecturer, has introduced his new book, The Source, Part 1. What could it be about? Well, this program tonight is going to be so synergistic, it just blows my mind. This book is the epic beginning of a trilogy about the Hollow Earth. As luck would have it, this weekend we also launched a crowdfunding event at Indiegogo, IndieGogo.com. If you go there and put in North Pole, you're going to get it. If you go to xsquaredradio.com, you'll see right there on the front page the widget for going directly to the crowdfunding event. And there are goodies to give away. Oh, yes. With as little as $10 contributed to the project, there are goodies that you get. Like, for instance, free 15-day access to the live streaming technology that will come from the ship. Or you can put a little bit more in and you can get the free DVD once it is produced by the producers. And this will probably sell for 20 years. Nothing like this has ever been made before or probably will ever be made again. You can also get a parka from the expedition that will keep you warm and have the expedition official patch on it. And yes, I know you've been waiting for it. 24 free passages on the ship, on the voyage. Yes, you have to contribute significantly to get that, but it is about a third the cost of what it would cost you to actually be part of this expedition. That goes out to first 24 that reach that level of contribution. Our team is mobilizing all across the world. That includes you. So you need to grab this widget, like it on your Facebook and Twitter, send it to your choicest email friends, and let's get this thing viral. It will only take a small contribution from each of the 42.5637 million enthusiasts that we have built up over the years for this Hollow Earth expedition. We're going to do it. We're going to make it. This July, we're going. If you want to be part of the program tonight, and I encourage you to do so because our author, lecturer, playwright, screenwriter, guest, Norlin Jacobs, will be happy to take your phone calls. We're going to talk about the Hollow Earth Expedition all night long, starting at 5:30 Pacific time, about 25 minutes from now. Our phone number. Anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. Or if you want to step out tonight and take advantage of some of those post-Christmas last few pieces of inventory sales that are going on out there, you could take your cell phone with you and you can listen to us in crystal clear digital audio by by dialing 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000. Then put in the passcodes 769-608. 769-608 pound. And you'll be in. You won't be able to talk to us, but you'll be able to listen. If you want to call in, use the numbers. We'll gladly take your call. Solar activity is still relatively low, but it is amazing nonetheless. The appearance of the sun suggests the quiet might not last. Over the weekend, a profusion of new sunspot groups peppered the solar disk with large cores, each one a potential source of eruptions. The NOAA forecasters estimate a 35% chance, that's very high by the way, of M-class flares and a 5% chance of X-class flares. Those are the most powerful during the next 24 hours. We have already had an M-class flare in the past few days. This solar cycle is not over yet. Don't forget that this is the most atypical solar cycle ever recorded. And we're talking about going all the way back to Roman times. December rolled out, rolled by without so much as a Y2K ripple. But the jury is still out, as they say. The solar wind is still a medium 352 kilometers per second. And the proton count is about five times as high as we normally observe. There are so many sunspot clusters facing the Earth that they are hard to count right now. They are moving, they're morphing, they're frothing. There is also a large coronal hole facing us at this time, and one coming around to face us. So you might not want to sell that bunker just yet. 9 million Chinese are without water tonight as the supply was shut off after it was reported that about 9 tons of toxic chemical was dumped into the water supply. Somebody down at the water treatment facility is probably new, probably can't read instructions, and they added the wrong stuff in the wrong amounts. Still, 9 million people without water, that's a serious situation. Tonight, after X Squared Radio is over, Coast to Coast host George Norrie is celebrating his 10th year with the 800-pound gorilla in paranormal broadcast radio. I will be one of his invited guests tonight, for which I am grateful. This is amazing and perhaps miraculous timing, as we have also launched a crowdfunding effort at Indiegogo.com, Indiegogo.com, to fund the expedition to the Arctic region. We need you to help spreading the word. If I have not already emailed you, would you please go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and get the crowdfunding widget right there off the front and share it. Okay? Do that. By the way, have you noticed a lot of your neighbors and maybe your neighbors' kids getting the flu? Well, flu infections are at near epidemic levels, believe it or not. 18 children dead so far of complications. And the CDC says it's going to get worse. The U.S. has been hit with a particularly aggressive early flu season this year, with widespread reports of the illness across the country, hospitalizing about 2,300 people. And health officials say the numbers haven't even peaked yet. Now, here's the strange thing. About a third of these people that have the flu got the flu shot. They got immunized. And now the rumors are abounding that maybe the people that started the flu epidemic are actually the people that made the flu vaccine. That immunizing people gives them a mild case of the flu. Evidently, it was contagious, and it is now spreading. So who's immunizing who? Who's starting the flu? Well, anyway, while the CDC is waiting for more time to pass before classifying the season, what's called the Google flu keeps on going. According to data being gathered by Flu Near You, Flu cases have increased dramatically over the past few weeks, and here are the season's most reported symptoms. If you have these symptoms, please don't get on the bus. Cough. 19% of people report a cough. 16% a sore throat. 15% fatigue. 14% a headache. 10% a body ache. And 7% a fever. Only 7%. It has already listed it as intense by monitoring flu activity around the world based on the internet search terms. And roughly 4% of users of Flu Near You, a real-time tracking tool, gaining about 100 new participants each week, say they're experiencing symptoms. Now, that's huge. Hang on a second. I just received an emergency text message about this. Oh, no. It's just a good luck with Coast to Coast. I have the posse listening. That's right. That's right. So spread the word. You've got a few hours. We don't go live for about 6 hours on Coast to Coast. And it will be sometime during the normal three-hour period between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. Eastern time that George calls me up. So we're going to talk about the Hollow Earth. You can bank on that. So get a hold of that widget. Spread it far and wide. Let's get this thing funded. We don't need that much money. Not when we're talking about as many people as know about this project. And also in the news, and this is really kind of strange. It's I guess it's like having a strategy game. Excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful grapefruit juice here. By the way, I mix it about 25% with. No, not vodka. No, water. Just water and grapefruit juice. It's delicious. Keeps the pipes working smoothly. If you live in the Washington, D.C. area, this message is for you. But it's also for you and you and you and you. And the reason is because this is not something we're used to seeing in this country. Now, you know, if you live in Pakistan, if you live in Afghanistan, if you live in somewhere where conflict abounds, maybe it's not so uncommon. But here, we don't really see this here. So this is kind of a PSA for you. Helicopters have been conducting radiation tests above portions of the Washington, D.C. area using remote gamma radiation sensing technology. I know it seems kind of strange. I mean, you're talking to somebody here, or actually I'm talking to you, aren't I, that has experience building gamma sensing technology. I have used it in the oil and gas industry for the sensing of radon gas as it comes up through the soil, comparing it with other nuclides. It's part of my proprietary process for finding viable oil and gas locations under the ground. Yes, it works 100% of the time. 55 oil wells can't lie. But we have tried it from the air, and it doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is because radon particles are very, very small. Radon is a nuclide daughter of uranium. Uranium deep in the ground decays into a daughter called radon. Radon migrates its way to the surface. It is an alpha decay nuclide. You breathe it in. It lodges in your lungs. It goes through an alpha decay. That alpha particle damages tissue, and yes, it can cause cancer. But radon is a very small particle, and my gamma sensor has to be right on the ground, and it literally has to be within inches of the ground without wind. And it has to be dry ground. It doesn't work over water. It doesn't work over rain-soaked soil because the radon particles get trapped in the water and they will decay in the water. Radon only has a half-life of about 2.5 days. That's why it's so dangerous to ingest because it decays so quickly. Now, a helicopter, last time I checked, has a tremendous amount of prop wash straight down. So the only way that a gamma sensing technology on a helicopter could work is if the particle somehow is whipped around by the blades and shoved into the detector. In other words, National Nuclear Security Administration, that's the NNSA, it doesn't work. It doesn't sense gamma radiation, okay? The only way that you can get a gamma detection in a helicopter is if you have a gamma event and the photon itself, which is massless, happens to be close enough that it can be picked up by the detector. Now, if you're going to drive these things around with a van and sense the air at ground level, yes. But if you're going to be sensing gamma radiation with a 200-mile-an-hour wind blowing straight down to the ground, good luck. The National Nuclear Security Administration has been flying the radiation missions since December 27th, just after Christmas, and they will continue until next Friday, January 11th. The flights have been conducted during daylight only, and the pilots fly about 80 miles an hour at 150 feet above the ground. So if you're flying a kite, if you're flying a radio-controlled airplane, and you get in the way of one of these helicopters, you are in big trouble. Naturally occurring radiation is measured so that the baseline levels can be established and used in security and emergency preparedness. Now, I can tell you, if these helicopters are flying over your house, the NNSA is making the public aware of the upcoming flights so that citizens who see the low-flying aircraft are not alarmed by the helicopters conducting the tests. The NNSA's remote sensing laboratory out of Joint Base Andrews will be performing the assessment for local law enforcement of Washington, D.C. Ha, how about that? Well, according to the organization, December 26th press release, NNSA's Office of Emergency Operations currently collaborates with more than 80 foreign governments and 10 international organizations with projects ranging from providing assistance to foreign governments in improving their emergency preparedness and response programs to joint collaborative activities to improve emergency management infrastructure worldwide. Now, I can tell you right now that a gamma detection flying 150 feet above the ground at 80 miles an hour is all but useless, absolutely useless when it comes to getting background radiation numbers. It doesn't work, folks. It's not feasible. Unless, and I got to tell you, plutonium driven around in a van doesn't give off gamma radiation. Sorry, folks. It's an alpha emitter. It takes a very special detector. It needs to be within a few feet of it, especially if there's shielding around it. And there needs to be no wind and no rain. It's very difficult to detect. Uranium, yes, you can pick up gamma scintillations. But there, it's going to be hard to pick up from a helicopter. You need to have no wind and no water to be able to pick this up cleanly. The only kind of technology that this is maybe useful for, the only kind of radiation event that this would be useful for, is the actual discharge of a nuclear weapon, either a dirty bomb or a plutonium bomb, hydrogen bomb. Yes, you would pick up gamma radiation for weeks and weeks and weeks in the area and even miles away as the fallout hits the ground. Fallout is actual particulate matter that is radiated and expelled by a nuclear blast into the air. If it is a above ground burst, there's going to be very little fallout. Most of the blast is going to go right down on the ground and flatten everything underneath the blast, and the EMP will go out about 600 to 800 miles in every direction. Yeah, 600 miles, folks. So if there's a blast anywhere in that region, you people all the way down to about Charlotte are going to have lights out for about 2 weeks. Helicopters won't be much good, I'm afraid, because it will take out all the short integrated circuits, which are key to actually starting and flying the helicopter. Just so you know, your tax dollars at work. Also, I wanted to give you an update on the Lifestream generator. Those of you that have listened to this program for a long time know John Riley. You know of ZeroPointResearch.com out of Santa Monica, California. You know about the Lifestream generator, and you know that officially there are no claims of treating or healing any disease. But those of you that have used the Lifestream generator or watched it used know the benefits. Well, guess what? There's a new article. The electric shock that could cure a headache by releasing the body's most powerful pain killers. It's absolutely true. What thousands of you already know by using the Lifestream generator in your homes or having used them with a practitioner coming to your home or place of business is now official. Scientists have managed to release the body's most powerful painkillers by running an electric current through the brain. The breakthrough has provided hope for sufferers of chronic migraines after it was found to reduce the pain of a headache by up to 37%. The technique, known as deep brain stimulation or transcranial direct current stimulation, alters the speed at which the brain's neurons fire. This, in turn, can relieve pain. The painkillers released by the brain were in endogenous opioids, the human's most powerful euphoria-inducing painkillers that are very similar to opiates, such as morphine. The new research conducted at the University of Michigan found that just a very small current of 2 milliamps, that's about how much you normally put out of your fingertips. If you actually grab a hold of a voltmeter and turn it on to DC, you'll see you put out about that much. Was enough to have the effect. 13 patients with chronic migraine defined it at least 15 attacks a month, had electrodes were placed above the motor cortex, the part of the brain responsible for voluntary movement. After 10 sessions over 4 weeks, the average person's pain threshold had increased by 37% after 4 weeks. The effects were cumulative and kicked in about four weeks of treatment, said Alexandre da Silva, assistant professor at the U of M School of Dentistry and lead author of the study, which appears in the journal Headache. Oh, that's a good name of journal, isn't it? This suggests that repetitive sessions are necessary to revert ingrained changes in the brain related to chronic migraine suffering. By boosting the release of natural painkillers, it's hoped that chronic migraine sufferers would be less reliant on medication, therefore reducing the side effects and the risk of addiction. There are other effects as well, and I'll tell you in a moment about the Lifestream generator, and then we're going to bring Norlin Jacobs, noted screenwriter, now author, lecturer. He has created a masterful book, and it is a chunk, let me tell you, an epic novel called The Source. And it is the first of three novels about one of our favorite subjects on this program, the Hollow Earth. And yes, we're going to have a long discussion about the Hollow Earth, so stay tuned. The Lifestream generator was invented and is manufactured by Zero Point Research, which is headed up by master genius John Riley. His website, ZeroPointResearch.com. The Lifestream generator, the small one, produces about 400,000 volts, very low amperage, of course, at a DC level with a specific rotating frequency. And I can't tell you what that is, but I can tell you after years of watching this machine work in and around not only clinics, but we'll call them energy experience centers and sessions, and I own one myself. And those of you that know me know that earlier this year, in March, I think it was in May, actually. Yeah, I broke my leg and my neck because I was T-boned by a young texting co-ed. I was on my motorcycle. She was in a car. That was hardly fair. But I took no morphine. I barely took an Aleve or two because the Lifestream generator took care of all the pain. Not only that, but even my orthopedic surgeon noticed that the bones seemed to knit together within hours. Not days, not weeks, hours. We took an x-ray the day of the accident. We took an x-ray 7 days later, and I was walking. Of course, my neurologist made me keep this horrible neck brace on for 6 weeks, but it wasn't necessary. And I can tell you right now that except for a little bit of residual deep tissue damage, I'm back to 100%. The Lifestream generator has a lot more effects than just that. Many of them neurological, that is to say with deep nerve tissue, with brain tissue, it has a lot of benefits. If you want to know more about it, I encourage you to find out, zeropointresearch.com, my friend John Riley. By the way, he doesn't know you're coming, so just introduce yourself and mention my name and you'll be fine. Norlin Jacobs is married to Charmaine Knight Jacobs, and between them they have 14 children and 8 grandchildren. He is the son of Norman and Flora Jacobs and is in the middle of their 11 children. Norlin is a versatile writer and currently holds a master's degree in dramatic writing from the University of New Mexico. While there, he instructed master classes in playwriting and served as the coordinating director for the university's renowned playwriting outreach program. Norlin served as the theater department chair for the Manatee School for the Arts, where he developed their entire theater curriculum, taught play and musical writing, and directed theater productions for several years. He is best known for directing the professional production of the original musical Saturday's Warrior. Those of you that know that musical will be amazed because lots and lots and lots of talent has come out of Utah schools, and nobody has been able to master the incredible, I'm going to call it cross-religious popularity of that musical, Saturday's Warrior. It was a smash hit that played to over 250,000 patrons throughout Western United States, and I think that number is way underestimated. I think it's in the millions. Norlin received recognition for his celebrated screenplay, The Reckoning, the musicals My Day and Honoring the Call, along with dozens of full-length and one-act plays. Please welcome with me Norlin Jacobs. How are you, Norlin?
And very excited to be speaking with you this evening.
Well, this is going to be fun. Norlin and I are both avid Hollow Earth enthusiasts, to say the least, aren't we?
Absolutely.
So I want to ask the question just to get things kicked off because as a scientist, I have to ask this question. What got you thinking about the Hollow Earth?
You mean what started me on my interest in it and researching it?
Yeah. How did you catch the bug?
Well, maybe I can set that up a little bit with the idea that I guess I've always been a little rebellious because in my eighth grade science class, my science teacher began to explain to me, as well as the rest of the class, that the Earth was like a basketball and that the outer shell of the basketball was like the outer layer of a, you know, or the Earth was like the outer layer of a basketball and that everything on the inside of that was molten lava. Not lava, but lead at the time. Originally, they decided that the liquid center of the Earth was made out of lead or molten lead. And that just did not ring true to me. And yet, I just couldn't accept that. It didn't make sense. So anyway, probably my second year in college, my brother-in-law came up to me and he says, "What would you think if the Earth was hollow and had a star, a central star on the inside of it, and had lands and things like that on the interior of the Earth?" Of course, my natural reaction at the time was bah humbug, because I had been educated in the same education system, public schools and such, and had been inundated and indoctrinated as to the solid Earth theory. And then he explained to me that there was a book. It was Bernard's book, and talking about the hollow Earth. And so I started reading it, and I wasn't really sold on the concept until I came to the statements of Admiral Byrd. And I thought somebody of that renown wouldn't be making those kinds of statements if there wasn't something to it. And so I started an avid research of it. And that was the beginning of, 40 years of research and investigation and trying to absorb everything that I could find out about the theory and the concept, and have been very, supportive of it and trying to share it with as many people as possible since that time.
Well, I know, having come up through academia myself, and the only subject that I ever taught on a college level was mathematics, so we never really got to talk about the interesting stuff like political science or geology or all the, just math, and having to make that interesting was a challenge enough, but nevertheless, built a lot of good math students over the years. And I got to tell you, most scientific minds who wrestle with this subject matter often sweep their notes about it into a secret drawer and don't speak about it to anybody, especially their peers. It's sort of like, Lemuria or Atlantis. It's a kind of scientific suicide, as it were. So what made you tackle this as a fictional novel?
Well, the reason I went that route is because I think more people need to know about it. And my approach was that with my screenwriting background, I was considering to write the screenplay first, because I started thinking in my mind, how can this story be presented in such a way that it could be entertaining, built around entertaining characters and likable characters, and yet still get the information out there that there is many, many facts that support the Hollow Earth theory. In fact, more so than the Solid Earth theory. And so I decided, let's think of a way. And considering my background and such, I thought wouldn't be interesting to have a radio interview program that could start up and start getting involved in talking to people about different subjects. And then how could we possibly get the story told, particularly of Olaf Jansen's story, the Smoky God, which I'm sure many of your listeners and enthusiasts are well aware of, except it was written over 100 years ago. And yet, except for that nucleus of avid fans who are aware of it, the Hollow Earth genre, the world in general doesn't know about it. And I thought the best way to get the word out there was to be able to make it into a movie. And then I thought, should I write the screenplay first, or should I write the novel? And so I decided to write the novel first, that we could have a foundation for the movie screenplay, which I hope to be able to also pursue. But in the meantime, we've got the book out there, and hopefully it presents it in such a way that it's entertaining. It's kind of the Indiana Jones kind of action adventure, and brings the story to the forefront.
Well, so when you say novel, I've read a lot of novels in my life, and this one is Stephen Clancy thick. It is not a novel like you're going to find in the bookstore. This thing's about, I'm hefting it here, it's probably close to 3 pounds in small print. And it's only the first of three, so we're probably looking at 2,400 to 2,500 pages by the time you get done with this trilogy. Did you start with an end vision of this project? I mean, it's an epic film that we're laying the groundwork for in this novel set. How do you write an epic by writing the first novel first?
Well, as the subtitle kind of indicates, this is part one, the seed. And so the seed is basically planting the seed, or the concept of the idea. And so I take my lead character, who is Mickey Urey, a la David Jensen. Mickey Urey is his radio name. And that's kind of explained in the book also, as how he comes up with that. And he is introduced to this concept himself through the character that had the experience of traveling to the interior of the Earth. So it plants the seed with him and the information and the basic information talking about the Hollow Earth, and then proceeds to take it a step further by having the opportunity to attempt or to go through the process of mounting his own or being involved with his own expedition. Sound familiar?
Yes.
And in fact, there's a lot of similarities with what you're doing and you do. And I started actually writing the book 30 years ago, actually, in 1980, but then life got in the way and everything else came up. And not only that, it wasn't time for it. We weren't ready for it. I didn't have enough information. There wasn't enough things that had been revealed. But now that that science has advanced and we've come across so many other things, it's introduced these other aspects that can be introduced in the book that also support the whole Earth theory. So this is the introduction.
I resonate with that because the first brush, of course, I had with the Hollow Earth is the same one most people did. You saw the old movie with, I guess it was about Arnie Sacknesson, and it had York in it, and it was a good movie if you're a kid watching a movie like that. And then the most recent one was Journey to the Center of the Earth, which was kind of hokey with little glow-in-the-dark birds and, you know, whatnot with Brandon Fraser. And that's about it. That's about the exposure most people get to the Hollow Earth. But somebody handed me a book back in 2001. We were writing the first volume of the Ark of Millions of Years series, which took us about 4 years to write because we actually wrote about 1,000 pages to start with, and then we launched the first 560 pages as volume one. But somebody handed me this book on the Hollow Earth, and I think it was called Our Hollow Earth, and it was I read it, and it was interesting, but there really, you know, I was had the same idea that you did, that we live on a molten ball in space, and we float around the top of this lava on dry tectonic plates like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. That made sense to me, and, you know, I was happy with it. But it sort of, you know, created that little itch in the back of my mind, and you're absolutely right. Between 2001 and 2006, we had enough seismic and satellite data come in to toss the molten Earth theory right out the window. And what amazed me about it is that the geological community, which I would have thought would have been hard after the truth, and the oceanographic community, which I had similar respect for, both completely ignored the data, even though NASA and JPL and some of the investors that were investing in satellite technology were hard after it, not with millions, with billions of dollars. They threw satellites up as fast as they could build them. And sure enough, the information was coming back like little pebbles in the double beam balance. Slowly but surely, it tipped over to the point where it was like, maybe the Earth is hollow. And so in 2005, I went looking for an expedition to try to seek out this north opening. And sure enough, there was one right out there in Utah with Stephen Curry. And I joined the expedition as a contributing engineer to build the gyroscope, you know, to measure the curvature of the Earth. So it was, from an instrumental point of view, the only way that we could determine whether we were actually sailing into an opening or not, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, events happened as they happened, and Stephen Curry very suddenly, very tragically passed away. Just like, you know, on rapid onset brain cancer hit him like a, you know, speeding car, and he was gone. And they, you know, appointed me in October of 2006 to be the expedition leader, and the rest is, you know, project history. So that's how I became involved. And I have to tell you, it's been difficult to stay in the mainstream with this subject matter because of books like The Smoky God. I read it, and it seemed plausible that this son of a sailing explorer was swept into a lower world with his father, and the idea that he was haphazardly rescued on the ice, where really no one dressed as he was dressed should have been alive at that time. It seems a little extreme, but still plausible. And he was able to tell his story after he got out of whatever incarceration the sane people put him in. But he didn't bring any evidence. And, you know, it's like personal testimony is personal testimony. And now I've, you know, almost read your incredible book. And actually, it's quite incredible. And you're sort of leading us like Jules Verne once did to the moon or to the bottom of the sea or indeed the center of the earth. And, you know, I want to know, are you going to take care of us on this journey of three books?
Well, I hope to. I mean, that's the idea. And I've from those who have read the book already, I've gotten a lot of response and feedback and such. And there, it's interesting how the information is presented. The character that I have, and I can basically reveal. I don't want to reveal too much about the book because I want that, you know, the dramatic reveal in the book to be, you know, there for those who read it. And hopefully that can be, you know, in the millions, because a lot of people who responded to it already are very excited about the storyline, about the characters, about how the information is presented and revealed. But it's presented, I think, in a very logical kind of a presentation with the character that's revealing it. I do some dramatic license in switching around. It is a fictional account. But there's so many facts that are built into it that we refer to it as a faction genre, and so it.
I like that.
Most of the facts and most of the elements in it, you can check. You can check it out. In fact, I've had several people, they start reading it immediately, and they go, boy, I read about that, and then I looked it up, and it's true. That's really happening. That's really going on. It excites people, like the Coral Castle in Florida and different things like that, and I'll let people discover it, I guess, in the book or look it up themselves. But these things that actually are there, that are mysteries to us that we don't understand, that are examples of levitation or people using that knowledge and that ability, it's one of those things where the more we investigate and try and, you know, look into these things, as I'm sure you have, you know, had a wealth of experience doing, the more questions it seems to raise, the more we're led into more possibilities and such. And so I try to present it as logically as possible and to do it through likable and believable characters and to present it in such a way that it's difficult to argue against the logic of the way that it's presented. And a lot of people seem to really appreciate that and enjoy it, and it allows them to think about the possibility. Now, I'm not going to sell my soul and say that this is absolutely true and every aspect of it is. It certainly isn't. There's a lot of creative license that's built into it, but it's all based on theoretical plausibilities and such. And so it, as a result, people can say, "Wow, that sounds fascinating, but it seems to make sense. It really seems like a possibility." And so the whole idea is to introduce people to the concept and the idea of the hollow earth, and even for the sake of the scientific world, to get them to open up their minds and sit there and say, maybe we should branch out in this. And that's why I admire what you're doing so much, is because you've come up through the academia, through the, you know, through the establishment of the physicist and what they have to go through and satisfy and everything to get their credentials, and yet having the, I guess, audacity or the nerve to branch out and to make claims on this from a scientific point of view before it's treated as metaphysical or something like that. But you're treating it like pure physics and that it needs to be explored.
Well, it isn't so much about the credentials because, you know, trust me, I know a lot of people with PhD behind their name that have to wear slip-on shoes. It isn't about that at all. It's about being able to successfully prosecute a case. It's like there are lots of attorneys that, you know, put innocent people in jail because of their inability to bring the facts to the case to establish the proof. And it's that way in science as well. And I see, you know, credible, you know, albeit, you know, widely published scientists who make effective cases, but who also throw out a lot of data that would refute their conclusions. And I see a lot of irresponsibility in and out of the science, both with the enthusiasts and those who actually do the hard research. And that's what kind of frustrates me the most about this project, is all of the evidence that we have gathered. At no point, even in my, you know, purely scientific objective mind, have I been the least tempted to say, oh, okay, hollow earth theory, you're out. That's it. It can't be plausible. The jury is still out. There is not enough evidence to throw this hypothesis out. And the only way to really, you know, effectively prove or disprove a hypothesis, in my mind, at least in the way that I do things, is I use what's called the null hypothesis. I try to prove that it is not so. And if I cannot do that, then it must be so. Otherwise, you know, I'm kind of tempted and prejudiced in the way that I present my evidence and my data and set up the experiment. We're bringing people who aren't really believers, including myself, that the Earth is hollow. Scientists and filmmakers and data analysts and even IT people. But they have an open mind and they have the right consciousness. They have an open, I'm going to say, an unfettered judgment about them. And if we put this kind of consciousness in the right place at the right time, if there is something to this idea that there's maybe some intelligence sitting on the bottom of the sea or inside the crust, maybe it will come out to see us. And when it does, we'll get it on film. That's the best that I can do. There's no way we're taking a 23,000-ton, 450-foot-long nuclear-powered Russian icebreaker inside the Earth. The best we can do is hope to take a core sample off the bottom, you know, with a 4,400-meter cable. Even if we could get that on the boat, I'll be surprised. But it's nevertheless going to be an amazing adventure. The main thing is no one's ever done it before. Well, that's an automatic 10 in my book. So as I said, it's not about the credentials and having, you know, slugged my way through lots of piles of Fourier transform to get where I am. It's about being able to effectively prosecute a scientific case. I've done it successfully for 30 years. I've done it for, you know, lots and lots of customers that have paid me lots of money. And now I want to do it. And maybe I'm a character in your book and don't even know it. But I can also tell you that a pure straight-up documentary is only going to have so many enthusiasts. Not nearly as many people watch Discovery Channel as watch Lost.
Of course.
So,
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's a great approach, you know, of how to approach this. But unfortunately, I don't think that's the majority of the scientific community. I think most of them are fairly defensive of their religion, so to speak, that they believe in this solid earth theory and that they're going to defend it to the death. And anything that threatens that, especially something as obscure and as threatening as a hollow earth theory, they are going to dismiss it. And you see that, I see it, and I've seen it in talking with people and researching and such, that that's more the case, is that they're more readily to quickly dismiss it and just pass it off as bah humbug and then go back to considering their Newtonian or, you know, whatever, you know, as far as their theories and such are concerned, and to support those and to try and come up with support and explanations of all of this new information that we're coming across. And that might be thematic with me, is that it seems like most of this new information that we're coming across, that that science is making available to us, supports the hollow earth theory, whereas the solid earth theorists are tap dancing and backpedaling and whatever they can to come up with whatever explanation they can possibly come up with, because they have no basis of understanding of how these things fit perfectly with the hollow earth theory.
That's true. You're absolutely right. And I wouldn't say no basis, but it's a disjointed basis. Like you mentioned Newtonian in the sentence. Newton had two sets of physics. One was called thin shell physics, and the other was called thick shell physics. Now, the thin shell physics made mathematical sense. Once you get on the inside of a sphere, there are virtually no gravitational forces because the gravity basically exists in the crust, and it is drawing you in all different directions at the same time, and so therefore it's zero gravity. Mathematically, that makes sense, but you know, we have never been able to empirically find a thin shell sphere anywhere in the universe to test it. Now, thick shell physics is even more of an enigma because it is just a polymerization of thin shell physics. In other words, it's just an infinite number of thin shells stacked one on top of the other to get a thick shell. except that we do have thick shell empirical data. We've drilled 8 miles into our planet, and we are finding nothing of the sort. There is no diminishing of gravity the deeper you go into the planet. Of course, we've only gone 8 miles. What would happen if we went 2,000 miles inside the planet or 3,000 miles inside the planet? Well, I think that if Newton is at all correct, at some point in there, gravity is going to start dropping. If it does, and I suspect he's probably right in this, there is no possible way planets could form as hollow spheres. Because when, I mean, as solid spheres. Because when you get in the center of the planet, gravity's zero. All the gravity's above your head. It has to attract away from the center.
Exactly, and that's my contention against the, you know, one of them, against the solid Earth theorists, as I argue. I said, so where is the center of gravity? Is it a pinpoint at the exact center of the Earth? Is it the size of a baseball? Is it a black hole the size of a basketball? I mean, what is it that you consider to be this point, this drawing point of the center of gravity? And yet, again, with the hollow Earth theorists and the mathematics and the things that go along with that, that have also been supportive of the hollow Earth theory, that with Al Snyder's and Newton's laws are full of flaws, and where he points out that Newton basically changed Kepler's laws of the universe, particularly one of them, and not putting down Newton, but, you know, because he did great work in many, many areas and, you know, initiated a great direction in physics, but in this one particular instance, which has to do with gravity and all these other things, they made a determination that the weight of the Earth needed to be a substantial amount, in fact, more than what the weight of the solid matter of the shell that we have, Mother Earth, weighs, and so that's why they had to come up with other theories. And then the seismologists came along and they said, hey, there's these basically three layers. There's this central core, and then there's this the inner mantle, and then the outer mantle, and the inner mantle doesn't reflect seismographic waves, so it must be a liquid. But unfortunately, if it was a liquid, the Earth wouldn't weigh enough, according to the Newtonian physics and the formulas that he introduced, and so they had to come up with that this must be a molten, you know, kind of a liquid, but it has to be heavy, so that's why they came up with lead at first, until they decided that lead wasn't as prevalent as what they had initially thought, and so now it's, I think they argue that it's a molten iron, and they have to require that for it to be able to weigh enough. But Al Snyder came up, he corrected the mistake where they dropped a square sign in the formula, in the equation, and recalculated it, and everything seemed to fit, because in physics there's all these problems that they ran into, that there were mistakes, that the formulas didn't work. And when Al Snyder corrected it, the formulas began working. Everything worked. I mean, the tidal rises, those kinds of things. In Newtonian physics, according to that formula, the sun had more gravitational pull on the moon than did the Earth. So there was a major problem right there. But when Al Snyder refigured it, he realized that the weight of the Earth was much less than what the Newtonian theories required. And as a result, he said the only way that it can weigh as little as it does is if it's hollow. And so that excited me, and I looked into that, and I, you know, looked at the calculations and stuff. Now, I'm not the mathematician. You know, I don't do the math, like you said, where you crank out the math and you do these, you know, figures and such. I'm more of the puzzle assembler. I look at the puzzle pieces and I put them together. And like you were saying before, for these people to satisfy their theories, they have to drop half of the facts to still be able to, you know, maintain their theory. Here's the facts that are presented to them, and like you said, they're staring them right in the face, but they have to ignore half of the facts to still maintain their conclusions. Whereas I try to look at all the facts and put the puzzle pieces together and say, well, let's approach it this way, and then let's tell a story around that idea and around that concept and around experiences and put all these facts in from all these different areas, and basically that's the way I came up with the plot for the story, and to be able to tell the story in an exciting and hopefully revealing kind of a way.
Well, that's what I think. Now, you know, when you're writing a novel, and we'll take a quick break here in about 2 minutes, so I want you to think about this question. When you're writing a novel that's going to be the basis of a screenplay, there are typically less than half a dozen main themes that go with movies, like boy gets girl, boy loses girl. There has to be an antagonist, you know, it has to be, you know, some kind of chase scene that you know, pulls the viewer along, because a movie is a visual experience. It can't all be, you know, lines. There has to be action. There has to be viewpoints and camera angles and tension and things that the viewer doesn't find out until after he himself, as the investigator, the viewer in the movie seat, puts the pieces together. And
yes, they say there's 7 genres and 33 plot lines. So that's what we're stuck with.
There you go. So we have enough mystery here to twist this thing around like a good thriller. But let's take a quick break. Just a little bit of music. We'll listen to some Leonard Cohen. Take a quick break. Relax the voice a little bit. And we'll come right back with more X Squared Radio after this. Don't go away.
Thank you. And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
I'm your host, Mickey Urie, coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. My guest tonight is Norland Jacobs, renowned screenwriter, instructor, teacher, lecturer, and now novelist of the most excellent nature. By the way, don't forget to pay our patrons a visit, the folks down at the Food Investor, Danny and Scott, out there in Utah, making excellent, high-quality, non-preservative food that will stay good for 30 years, set it and forget it. You click on that link, pick up some food storage, and send it to your loved ones. That's the gift that keeps on giving. We've come through a couple of years of disasters, earthquakes and tsunamis and storms, and I think that we're not out of the woods yet. If you think that FEMA is going to take care of you, bring you three square meals a day, a warm blanket, and hot cookies and cocoa, I think you have another thing coming. No one is coming. So take care of yourself. Take care of those that are close to you. Visit, invest in food, the Food Investor, please. Also, if you want to be part of the program tonight, don't worry. The phone lines are open anywhere in North America. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. If you're outside of North America, no worries. If you're anywhere on planet or off planet, you can get to a cell phone tower. You can get to us at 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. If you must step out, I know, it's difficult to do. You don't want to miss a word. That's okay. You can call 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then dial the passcode 769-608-pound, and you can listen to us on your Bluetooth while you're walking around the mall. So no worries. You can be part of the program. Let's welcome my guest back, Norland Jacobs. We're talking about his incredible book, The Source, which is part one of a trilogy that is going to be the basis for a series of epic movies. So, by the way, this is Brooks Agnew, not Mickey Urie, but that's the character in his book that plays, well, maybe me in the book. And it's pretty synergistic how a talk radio host is first exposed to the story of the Smoky God. And I'm sure even in his incredulity, his curiosity is piqued like I hope yours is. If it gets piqued enough, please go to my website at x2-radio.com and grab the widget for the real North Pole Inner Earth Expedition and spread it around. Be a part of it. Contribute 50 cents, $10,000. Be a part of this real expedition. Who knows? Maybe the footage from this voyage will go into the footage that makes the movie. What do you think, Norland?
Wouldn't that be exciting? It's and you mentioned also that you might be the Mickey Urie. I thought that was fun because I have actually had someone who read the book and then listened to your Red Ice radio interview And they said, no one's going to believe that you two didn't get together, and, you know, 2 years ago when I started writing the book and you know, came up with this plot line and came up with this idea, no one's going to believe that you guys didn't get together to do this. But we talked to each other, 11 days ago or something? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we actually, you know, made the first actual contact. But it's kind of interesting, the similarities. There's many, many, many in the book that are just almost oddly or mysteriously coincidental as far as the parallels that real life is producing now compared to the fictional account that we have in the book. But hopefully the book's going to be very exciting and can be something that people can really get into. And like you said, as the first part of the trilogy, and you asked earlier, if I had the concept in mind and you asked for book two, which is going to be subtitled The Sowing, and then the third book is going to be The Harvest. And basically, I do have in mind every aspect of what it's going to, you know, be, the skeletal form of the plot. And I'm well into book two already, and it's just a matter of putting the flesh on the bones. So it's fleshing out very well, and I'm getting some great response off of book one so far.
Well, we hope to get more. By the way, the link to the source is at x2-radio.com. If you're a subscriber, you can go to January 1st of 2013 just by clicking on the archives button there at X Squared Radio. And all you have to do is click on the link, and it'll go right to the Amazon listing of the book. That's the best place to buy the book, is it not?
Yes, Amazon has it. It's also available on Kindle Books, and then you can get the ebook off of CreateSpace, www.createspace.com. So it's available in print, ebook, and also Kindle. So
excellent.
Yeah, you're going to actually have that tangible 3-pound book in your hand. the Amazon.com link is a great place to go.
Well, not many people know how epic begins. What does epic mean? When people say it's an epic tale, what does that mean? You're a literary instructor.
Well, it's kind of along the lines of saga, which means you go through a long period. You know, you go through this journey that your lead character has, and it takes you through many phases of their experiences. So it's epic in the sense that it's long and it covers a long period of time, and yet you can really get into the characters and identify with the characters, and that's why we've approached this way, because, well, it's like, you know, to drop a few names like The Hunger Games or the Twilight series or Lord of the Rings or whatever, they go through this whole sequence and generations of experience, as you might say, you know, and so it's set up in that way that we experience first the story of the Smoky God told in what I hope is a clever approach to it that kind of modernizes it and brings the story in fresh, and then introduces the concept to the point that action is taken on it, so that there's an expedition and other things that are going on in it. And then that's within the seed book and excitement. And then the next part, the sowing, is as in planting the seed in the earth. So there's a little metaphorical concept there. And then the third book being the harvest, and that is reaping the benefits of the or the rewards from those experiences. So epic in going through all of those phases in the three books. But right now, the initial book is The Seed, and it's out there and available, and it can really introduce someone to the Hollow Earth concept in a way that hopefully they can get excited about it. It'll introduce them to it, and they can read The Smoky God. They can start studying it themselves. But when we make it into the movie, which I just really have a strong conviction that we're going to be doing, everyone who reads the book says that they can see the movie unfolding. They just really get excited about the way that it's presented and what a great movie it's going to make. And many people start casting it already. Oh, who's going to play Mickey Urie? You know, the DJ, the interviewee, the host of what he calls Mickey's Enigmas, and how he gets into that and how it starts up and how some of his you know, experiences and things that he has, so we can understand. It's kind of fun approaching it from the DJ, the radio world. Everybody listens to radio, but you know, there's just a handful of movies that have even addressed that particular approach, you know, of learning about the radio biz while you're enjoying it or while you're seeing it. Even though everybody listens to radio, they don't know that much about the work.
A lot of people don't realize it because, you know, we're kind of a television/, you know, smart peripheral society now. We can hit YouTube and blast around the world in a matter of 30 minutes. Everybody in the world can be watching an event that just happened. But no real genre really affects society quite like radio. We don't really know why that is, and radio is kind of weird in the sense that, you know, when something happens, it gets blasted out over an AM or FM radio station. It has to be picked up by another station, even if it's syndicated, you know, like ABC News at the top of the hour or Westward One or one of the other news programs. It gets missed. You know, if you don't catch it right at that 6 minutes at the top of the hour, you know, it doesn't play every 6 minutes for an entire day. You missed that news broadcast. You missed it. But for some strange reason, and I don't know if it's my parents' generation, which sat around and listened to the radio, listened to programs, not just music, but programs on the radio. I remember sitting out on the back porch as a kid listening to baseball games on the radio. Who listens to baseball games on the radio anymore? I mean, a few people do when they're driving around, but we watch TV. TV's really, you know, really the media for watching sports. And yet radio
is kind of subliminal now. It kind of affects you as you're doing other things, and it's there, and it's playing in the background, or while you're driving. And there's really a captive audience with the drivers that are out there and such. But, again, everyone listens to it, but it has this subliminal effect that you hear about things, and then you follow up on the other means of communication. I mean, we're in a world of information and communication and such that you follow up on these other smartphones or whatever it may happen to be. But the way that to really reach the masses is through the movie avenue, and that's where it really gets out into a lot of people's hands. And like you said, there's the couple of movies that have been out there. One, you know, the Journey to the Center of the Earth, the Jules Verne adaptation, was interesting and yet in a way kind of a hokey resolve to the situation. And then other follow-ups to it have been even hokier, you know, where dinosaurs are running around chasing people and, you know, grabbing them by the seat of the pants and they barely escape. And, you know, all these kind of hokey approaches to it, which kind of denigrates the concept that the hollow earth physics and the mathematics behind it and the actuality of it is a needs to be seriously considered, because as you're on the verge of doing, this could possibly be the greatest discovery in the history of mankind, and that doesn't need to be treated lightly. You know, since Columbus discovered that the world was round and opposed to flat, and the fear that led up to it, that they thought they were going to drop off the edge of the earth if they didn't find land soon, and so on and so forth, you may plan on not being able to achieve much more than maybe having someone contact you, but if that were to take place, you might be surprised that there might be much more that you might be able to glean out of this expedition.
Well, of that I have no doubt. I could tell you that I've gone through a lot of emotional and even scientific changes since I started this project. I am used to taking measurements with, you know, various kinds of calipers or gauges or sensors of one kind or another, gathering data, printing it out, making charts and graphs and predictions and, you know, extrapolations and even regressions to find answers. But I'm not really used to taking measurements with my body, with my feelings. I don't think I can remember a project where I've said, well, I feel like this is the right adjustment to make. I'm sure everyone would look at me like, what the heck are you talking about? You feel like this is the right adjustment to make. Either you're going to turn it up or turn it down. You're going to make it hotter, cooler, faster, more pressure. But you got to have a reason for doing it, not just, hey, let's see what happens if we do this. I got to tell you, you know, August 17th of 2006, I know the exact day. I know the exact location. Brooks Agnew changed. I was 52 years old, folks, set in my ways. I was so set in my ways, the concrete had long since set with steel rebar. And at age 52, in a matter of 30 minutes, I changed. And I've already had one mighty change of heart. I can tell you that right now. I know all about the Lamanites and the Nephites and everywhere they came from and everything that's said about them. But I had another mighty change of heart that was even equally as incredible. Only it is credible. And when the pieces began coming together, and I think I told Norlin about this on the phone when we talked earlier this week, they were undeniable, folks. I mean, I already told you about August 17, 2006. Well, in April of 2007, I was speaking at a conference in Hawaii. I was invited out there by Michael Solis and Angelica Whitecliffe to speak on the Hollow Earth. And I was speaking, I was the last speaker on Sunday. So no one had even heard me yet. And no, I had never published anything. I still haven't published anything on the Hollow Earth. So I'm sitting there at my table, minding my own business, getting ready to sell books, you know, to people who didn't even know me. But this woman came up to me, I would say middle-aged, very, you know, attractive, white person living in Hawaii. I don't know what you call those. But anyway, she came up to me. She said, I have a message for you. I said, oh, great. And I was thinking maybe, you know, the conference organizers had a message for me. Please fold up your table and go home. No, she said, I have a message from you from Eight Whale Brothers. I went, oh, this should be interesting. She said, do you have a piece of paper? I said, sure. And I opened up my lab notebook to the next blank page because I was going to read from it during my presentation, handed her a pen and said, here you go, record it right here. So she drew a circle, and inside the circle she put eight squares, and outside she put these eight what looked like fish, and she began to talk. And she said, somewhere in the recent past, you have been given a series of plates. On these plates have drawings, schematics, maps, charts, graphs. Now, all this was figurative, mind you, because I really did receive a massive download, as I told you, on August 17th, the year before. But she didn't know that. I hadn't told anyone. And then she said, there are eight whale brothers that want me to tell you that they're watching for you and that they know that you're going to make it up there and they're going to greet you. And we talked a little bit more, and I can't remember all the details because I don't have my lab notebook open right at the moment. But I said, well, that's very nice. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed that. I closed my book, kept selling my books. The next day I made my presentation, and then we were going to go swim with the dolphins on Monday morning. So we go out to the boats. There are two boats. They're pretty fast boats. They carry about 30, 40 people. Half of the group got on one boat and roughly half on the other. I think there were about 25 people on our boat and about 28 or 29 people on the other boat. So we started putting out of the harbor at 5 knots, whatever, you know, because they have a wake rule not to go too fast out of the harbor. So I ask Angelica, she's on my boat, Angelica, you think we'll see any whales today? Oh, no, she said. They've all gone north a month ago. We won't see any whales today, just dolphins. Well, I said, oh, well, okay. In my heart, I was a little disappointed because I was thinking about what the lady had told me a couple days before. So the boats get out of the harbor, and we whip up to about, I don't know, 45 miles an hour. We're spreading out, getting further and further apart. The other boat's probably, oh, 200-300 yards ahead of us. And off to the west, I guess it would be. We're heading for the north shore. And all of a sudden, about 2,000 feet in front of the boats, there's this whale blow. Well, by law, both boats have to go to an idle and let the whales pass. Now, they weren't swimming in our direction. They were kind of swimming, you know, perpendicular to us. But and the other boat was further ahead from us and off to our left. But those whales turned toward our boat. And I've got my video camera, so I fire it up and I start filming those whales heading for us. And those whales swam straight for our boat while I made my way to the front, and I hung so far over that handrail I thought I was going to fall into water. I even asked, can I jump in with them? No, nope, you can't do that. That's illegal in Hawaiian waters. Sure enough, eight whales. One by one, they swam by the front of the boat, and they turned and sailed or swam off north, and they never came back. There was not a dry eye on our boat, let me tell you. It was so amazing. There's no way this woman could have known that. No way she could have made it happen. And yet, pieces like that have been falling in place for the last 6 years.
Well, I can identify with that. I've been through similar experiences and such in the culminating of this because, like I said before, when I started this, many years ago, after doing a great deal of research and reading everything voraciously about the Hollow Earth and trying to come up with some kind of conclusions, for one, trying to say, well, this isn't possible, and then finding out the more that I read, the more it seemed possible and the more it was supported. And but then in the writing of it, I had the book maybe half done, and I thought, it's not time. It's not ready. I need more information. There needs to be more information that needs to be revealed. And then it's been only recently that I've been writing on it this last 2 years, not even knowing about the original with Steve Curry putting together the original expedition, and then really focusing and concentrated writing until I was able to finally finish it in April of this year, or, well, of last year now. And then making contact with a friend of yours and someone I followed for a long time, and that was Rodney Clough, and his writing of Our Earth is Hollow, and he's like an encyclopedia of every resource and information that you can have on the Hollow Earth, and identifying with that and finding out the same resources and the thoughts and those kinds of things. But having several experiences myself of new information or puzzle pieces fitting together and that are revealed in the book, and that are answers and some conclusions of some things that have been going on and happening that kind of want to, you know, throw out there as a tease, you know, for those people who want to read the book and discover those things. But there's some answers to some new information that's out there. And then, personally, I think our getting together was just kind of almost bizarre and such as far as this expedition coming to a culmination here and the book talking about extremely similar things and parallel things to it. It seems like there's this synergy where, like you say, things are coming together, and there's been a lot of things that have been building up and building to this so that I have those same positive thoughts and anticipations and everything that maybe the time is right, and maybe it is time for these things to be revealed. And revealed, what I mean by that is that for some reason these things haven't been forthcoming in the past, whether it's been the scientific community resisting it or academia refusing to entertain it or whatever it may happen to be. It seems like that there's a nucleus of people who hear the concept of the Hollow Earth, and whether they reject it at first or not, like many of us did and have and still are doing, that when the information that's available out there, the truths that are there, the facts, like you said, that are there and become more obvious to the point where it becomes less and less deniable, then it seems like maybe it's time for some things to start coming to the forefront, and that your expedition has that kind of kismet or that kind of, you know, support that that it's going to happen, it is going to be fulfilled, and it's nice to have little signs of that kind of support or those things kind of coming forth, like the eight whale brothers and those kinds of things. I can imagine how just communing with nature like that would generate, you know, those emotions, but the fact that it's that it's a kind of a fulfillment of some kind of a prophetic message that you received, it's even that much more exciting. And there's been many, many experiences. I'm sure every writer, and I'm speaking to writers out there, have had that experience that when they're writing, you almost go into this trance-like state or whatever. You get into the characters, you're writing, and then you go back later on and you come back and you say, gosh, did I write that? You know, where did that come from? How did that happen? Whatever. And I'm sure you as a writer and author yourself, maybe not as much because you don't deal with fiction and fantasy that much, but it's still, there's times that that there seems to be kind of an auto-writing that takes over and takes place, that people refer to it as inspiration and other things and such, but it seems like oftentimes that there's a gift of information or a gift of flow of knowledge and those kinds of things that come through that discipline and that effort of writing things.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, and I'll keep the lines open for those writers out there. You know, I started writing when I was really young, and I was published when I was 13, and I at a very young age, had to overcome a weakness, which is very typical of Geminis, I guess, and that is that Geminis have a tendency to start lots of projects and never finish anything. So at a very early age, I was much more cognitive, I would say, at a young age than most anyone else my age. I was not a kid very long, let's put it that way. I forced myself to be a finisher. I wasn't insane about it. It wasn't like I'm going to finish this or die. But I don't leave projects undone. I either close them or I finish them, and that's the way I was with my writing. I decided at a very young age I was going to be a professional writer. And the difference between a professional writer and an inspired writer is that an inspired writer will leave the pad and the pen sitting on the table for years until they get the inspiration to sit down and write. Well, you can't write books that way. Nobody ever writes books that way. You can write a poem, you can write an article or a short story, but you can't write a book. A book means you have to sit down every day, almost at the same time every day, and you have to write one paragraph, one page, one chapter. It flows, and sometimes it doesn't. But you must write every day. It's a job sometimes.
Absolutely.
Other times, it's like going to the gym and get on that elliptical machine, and after you get past that first 10 minutes where you would rather get off of that machine than eat chocolate ice cream. But once you get past the 10 minutes, you're in the groove. And I have to concur, there's a high when you get into the characters and you start writing. Now, here, you say I've never written any fiction or fantasy. I have. I wrote, my first published article was an article called Black Cars Are Faster. And I made 4 cents a word on it, selling it to a magazine. But after I published the first 3 Arc of Millions of Years series, and I was on George Norrie's program, I think, the 4th or 5th time, Harvey Rockman called me from Florida. He was one of the prequel producers for the Twilight series. Called me up and said, I want you to write a screenplay. Well, I, of course, have heard the word screenplay before, but that's about it. I'd never written one. So I bought the Final Draft software, which is the best screenwriting software out there. I think you'll agree with that.
Yeah.
And I hacked out the screenplay, but it took me 6 months. And here's why. Because I was down in Mississippi on a contract. My hotel was about 25 miles from this plant that I was dismantling and moving to Texas. And that 25-mile drive to work and home became two-wheeled meditation for me because I rode my motorcycle. And I wrote that screenplay while I was riding the motorcycle. When I would get back to the hotel, I couldn't wait to get my laptop open, and I would make the next step at it. Well, I finished it. It's about an 89-page screenplay, which is long for screenplays, but it is a solid, big-screen, high science fiction CG kind of movie called Birth. B-E-A-R-T-H. Like Born Earth, only combined. Birth.
And it's
a story. And the characters and the scenes and how it all came together was just like you say. It was like an out-of-body experience almost in
writing. Writing or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was very metaphoric, and the characters developed and had their own personalities, and I got to know them, and you know, I never did anything with the screenplay other than show it off at a few contests where it did well, but I wouldn't have the least idea how to fund a movie. I can barely fund an expedition above the Arctic Circle, so it's just an accomplishment and that I have empathy with. So those writers that are out there, heed my words. If you're going to be a writer, whether it's with a pen and paper or with a laptop, do it every day. Hack through it. Make yourself do it and become a professional writer, and you will love it.
Well, it's like any muscle that you exercise or that you want to develop. You have to do it consistently. You have to have that repetition and such, and before you know it, it starts being easier. And then again, you slip into that euphoric mode almost, that auto-writing mode where it's almost like you're rewarded, or that there's a gift of knowledge or flow of thought and those kinds of things that go along with it, even though that's not always the case. Like you were saying, sometimes you're just cranking it out and such, and you might have a, you know, garbage basket. Well, it used to be a garbage basket full. Now you just delete, you know, or save it to another file or whatever for a later date. But anyway, you still have to go through that process. But just like the scientific process, it's like you have to write down what's not usable before you can discover what is usable. Does that make sense? It's just
It does make sense. I'm going to try that next time. I think about James Cameron when he wrote Avatar. He had this idea for this set of movies about Avatar, and he needed to wait until technology caught up with what he really wanted to do with this movie. And you have to admit, you know, whether you like the story or not, it was captivating. The photography, the CG was absolutely off the scale phenomenal.
Yeah. Yes, it was. And, you know, it's going to take that kind of technology, like you said, to be able to create the visuals that are presented in the source, because it's taking us to a whole new world, and to be able to visualize that can be helped through, like you said, the CG, the different kind of technologies and things that we have to be able to create that imagery so that people can really get caught up into it and excited about it. But still, irregardless of what technology we can throw into it, stories, whether in movies or novels, still have to be character-driven. And that's what I was hopeful to be able to do, is to develop very likable characters.
Yeah, and we're a sophisticated audience. You know, we don't want to figure out the plot in the first 30 minutes of the first movie. You've got to, you know, hold us in suspense, because that's what we like, and that's difficult to do making a movie. Now, you mentioned, you know, not only did you find a lot of synergy, you found a lot of passionate hooks as the team starts coming together, and like people told you, are you sure you didn't know Brooks Agnew before you started writing this? as the pieces of the puzzle are laid into place, it's almost like there's a master puzzler up there going, okay, let's move this piece over next to this piece now. In the people that you have met, and you know, the walls that you bounced your thoughts off of over the years putting this together, what is the passion of people that hear this story? Is it that they just say, oh, that's interesting? Or do they say, you know, I've been dreaming about this since I was like 5 years old? What have you run across, Norlin?
Well, I've run the gamut. You know, it's been all extremes. But for the most part, now I've talked to people in academia, and I've shared some of those experiences, like with Robin, your cohort and such, where I have talked to chairman of physics departments and discussed the theory with them, and basically with the support material that I had, they were rather confounded by the time we you know, finish talking about it. They resisted it tooth and nail, you know, the whole time. But they had come across information that had that didn't fit their theory. For example, a CAT scan of the Earth that revealed continents on the inside of the Earth. And when this got into print, I called up the people responsible for it, and I started talking to them about it. And basically, I won't identify who and what and where, but it's kind of easy. Well, I mean, it's not that easy, but someone did an experiment where they did a CAT scan of the Earth, and they discovered continents on the inside of the Earth. At least that's what the lead-in, the headline of the article in the Science magazine was. And I called up the people, and this was several years ago in my, you know, youth—not really youth, but you know—in my, how should I say, my aggressive nature of supporting the concept. And I said, I wanted to congratulate you on the story about the CAT scan of the Earth. It's very interesting that you came across this. And what they did is they had discovered that there was this, these continent-looking images that were located between the molten lava or molten lead or iron and the inside crust of the Earth, the inside mantle of the Earth. And that's what the CAT scan had revealed. And they were saying, now this is, you know, where the molten lead had cooled and had formed kind of this crusted layer and such. And so that was their theory, and that's how they had described what they had discovered. So I called him up, and we were able to discuss it. And I said, now, have you done follow-up experiments on this? And they said, yes, we've done follow-up experiments on it, because actually the experiment that they had done, that they had written about, had taken place about 2 years before. And they said, we've done follow-up experiments on it. And I said, well, I haven't seen anything in print on that. I said, have you printed anything on the results of that? And he says, no, we haven't yet. And I said, let me tell you why. And I said, "What? The reason you haven't printed anything on this is because what you discovered was that these continents were exactly the same as they were the first time you discovered them, and that doesn't match your theory of it being a molten crust that reforms and remelts and then reforms and so on and so forth." And there was a long, silent pause. And then we continued to discuss what he thought it was, or their theory, but he didn't deny that that's what had taken place, and he didn't argue against that. But what he did argue against is, I said, well, and actually the molten layer that you claim to be molten is an atmosphere. And he said, well, it can't possibly be an atmosphere because there's too much pressure down there. It would expel all the gaseous, you know, atmospheric, you know, layers. And I said, well, not if there isn't that much pressure down there. If there isn't pressure down there, if there's a crust and the rest of it's hollow, the strength of the, you know, concave area or the shell would dissipate that pressure, and there wouldn't be any pressure on the inside, and an atmosphere could exist. So this was just kind of my novice putting the puzzle pieces together, but as I presented these things to him, he was confounded, and he would argue against it. He says, well, yeah, but it can't because of this and this and this. And I said, well, that's basically because of the Newtonian physics that you're having to defend, and that you've always defended and learned and supported and such. And basically, by the end of it, the argument was, he says, well, this is the best model that we have. This is the best model that we have of the Earth. And I said, yes, but if the model is wrong, maybe you need to reconsider, because you have the facts right before you. And the facts are telling you that your theory is wrong and something else needs to be considered. So that was just one discussion and one encounter that I had with many people in the different fields and what their response to it for. But in the answer to the rest of your question, that many other people, well, a lot of people look at the hollow earth theory and they consider it to be very interesting, at least I've found. They treat it as being very interesting. They're kind of interested in it and excited about it. And that's just in the, you know, when they're considering just the general theory, the general concept. First, they have to struggle with what they've been taught their whole life, but then they start to kind of say, well, gee, maybe there's something to that. That sounds really interesting. What's the possibilities? And, you know, think back to the old Jules Verne, you know, Journey to the Center of the Earth and whatever else that's kind of alluded to that idea. But then the people who have read my book, because of the way that it's presented, and we try and present it a very logical way with characters telling their story and sharing that, they become very enthusiastic about it, and they become almost to the point of that they're become avid supporters of it, because they say it's so logical, it makes so much sense, that it just they get really excited about the possibilities and really excited about
that's when you
this potentially being discovered.
When they come and they go, yeah, but Norlin, this is just a story, right?
Well, that's kind of our little teaser, you know, did this really happen? I mean, and we kind of say that. You'll be asking yourself, did this really happen? Did this really take place? Is this place really real? Because it's just so logical and all of this makes so much sense. The way that it's all put together and in the story, they just get so caught up in it. Some people just say that they start reading it and they just get so caught up in it because there's so many facts that are woven into it that are undeniable, and the way that it's presented, that's oftentimes the question that I get. Did this really happen? I've even had somebody say, have you been there? Did you really go there? I mean, you know, have you been, you know, so it's like, and I say, well, no, of course I haven't been, but there are people who have claimed that they have been. And this story is a tribute to them, tribute to Olaf Jansen and the Smoky God. And there's other people, Lon Merton, other people who have written about this experience and having experience of traveling. And then, of course, history is full, as you know, in the facts that whether it's whaling ships and reports and logs and everything else of viewing what they call the mirror sun, the reflected sun, that in actuality, if according to the Hollow Earth theory, is the central sun being exposed or revealed to them, but to the point where they can see a sun behind them and see a sun in front of them. These are just a tidbit, a morsel of the kind of facts and the experiences and the observations. The Cook-Perry race to the North Pole, that they started registering the information that they were experiencing, and which later challenged their credibility because they couldn't travel, you know, 100 miles in a day when they'd only been able to crank out, you know, 5 or 10 prior to their run to the, quote, pole. And so it challenged their credibility, whereas if they'd have looked at the facts of what was going on, and if they were taking their readings, and their readings were being calculated according to the actual circumference of the Earth compared to the circumference of maybe a polar opening and the lip around a polar opening, then we might have discovered more of a reality of the Earth's cosmology before you are going to be discovering it, or at least being able to actually measure it and see. You know, I mean, they've taken measurements before where they say, well, isn't it interesting that the level of the ocean that's surrounding us is, you know, level from to the sides, but the ocean behind us is level, but the ocean in front of us seems to be tilting downwards, you know, if they're heading towards the north. So, I mean, this is a compilation that people can find and discover in many, many books that are out there, and, of course, with Rodney Clough's information and resource from Our Hollow Earth and these kinds of things where they can check out these sources. And what I've done is taken all of these, pulled them in together, and tried to put in a very fascinating and fun and action-packed and what people say is a page-turner, you know, that they just get all caught up into it in reading the story and then getting sold on the idea. And the whole idea is to introduce people to the Hollow Earth concept, kind of prepare them for when it becomes a reality, maybe they might be ready to accept it.
I'm similarly amazed. I've lectured around the world on this expedition and the building of it, and it's... you know, it's about a two-hour lecture by the time you present all the data and the viewpoints and the photographs. And I spoke with Dr. Y. Sessions at Washington University. He and his grad students had gone through 600 seismograms, which they're just prints of vibrations that occur. Norlin mentioned CAT scan. It's a similar process. We used to call it nuclear magnetic resonance, but patients didn't like the word nuclear, so now we just call it CAT scans. Basically, what we're doing is taking a rotating magnetic field and we're bouncing it off of layers of tissues, changing the focal point so that we can take literally slices of images of the human body, and the software is able to tell us, you know, whether there's a void or a more dense tissue or whatever there. And then through the physiology training of the doctor, they can interpret that. Well, we don't really have surgical experience with the earth, so we just imagine what those voids and layers are. How it occurs, we don't hook a giant machine around the earth, although some people think that HARP is a machine like that. We take advantage of the earthquakes when there's a really hard thump on the earth, and these occur anywhere from 25 to 150 miles deep into the crust, well below any place we've drilled. That vibration not only goes across the ground in what's called P waves, but it also goes through the earth in what we call S waves. And these waves bounce off various structures and end up at other listening stations around the planet. And we're able to get kind of a picture of what the inside of the planet looks like. And like Jan Lambrecht and others have discovered, there are places of demarcation inside the planet. Some of those waves, especially the S waves, bounce off and go zipping back up to the surface and back down again. And they end up reflecting and coming up in places that aren't really expected. So in the textbooks, they draw a dotted line for these waves and they call them shadow waves. They just invented because they got to make it fit their view of the earth. But if you take someone like Jan Lambrecht and you look at his way of looking at the waves, instead of measuring them from the point of origin to the listening stations, he starts at the listening stations and works his way back to the point of origin. And when you do it that way, well, all the shadow waves go away. All the shadow zones go away. And what you get is a nice, crisp, clean view of a crust that's about 1,800 miles thick, which makes total sense. That leaves an inner core void of somewhere about 3,000 to 3,500 miles. Now, if you take a solid core, say a solid iron crystal core, very dense, somewhere around 8 to 11 grams per cubic centimeter, it would have to be almost a perfect iron crystal, which, by the way, the Japanese have measured the frequency of it and have said, spectrographically speaking, it is an iron crystal. Now you've got enough weight for the Earth to be where it's supposed to be in this orbit and void between that solid core and this couple thousand mile thick crust with somewhere between 800 to 1200 miles of atmosphere. And the world's the right weight. Now there's one piece of missing data that we haven't told you about yet, and that's a point of equilibrium we call Lagrange points. Lagrange had a way of calculating the points of equilibrium of any orbit around an orbiting mass or a central mass. And these would be an equidistant point between the two masses that would be a point at which it would neither be attracted nor repelled from either body. In other words, a perfect center point. And when these points are calculated and measured exactly between the sun and the earth, they're 1,200 kilometers short of being the center of Earth. It ends up somewhere in the crust. And they've just kind of written it off saying, well, we don't really have true density measurements of our planet, but based on our orbit, how long it takes us to go around the sun, we know exactly how much the Earth is supposed to weigh. We just don't know how it achieves that weight. And that's why this Lagrange limit is 1,200 kilometers short, somewhere in the center of the crust, which is where hollow earth theorists say the true center of gravity lies. So it's interesting.
Yes. Very interesting. It kind of fits Al Snyder's formula much better, especially if the earth is porous. I actually took his figures and projected as to when he said, well, the earth has to be hollow, and I figured out, well, if it has to be hollow, according to his numbers, how hollow would it be? And the minimal thickness of the Earth, according to his formulas, was 850 miles, approximately. But with the Earth being porous, and like you said, if there's an ocean underneath our oceans, you know, that's within the crust, and if it's porous and there's, you know, the honeycombed kind of a feel, which is actually, we understand, is a stronger formation, you know, like elephant bones are honeycombed and are stronger than what a solid bone would be, that if it is honeycombed with caverns and openings and oceans and all these kinds of things, then that 1,800-mile thickness could be very applicable to, like you said, a, you know, still having a very thick 1,200-mile atmosphere. And when you compare that to the 10 miles of atmosphere that we have on the exterior of the Earth, 1,200 miles is a pretty thick atmosphere. And a lot of things can be, you can be protected by a central sun that's there, especially if it's got a terrarium effect and there's cloud coverage continuously so that you don't see the sun, like Olaf Janssen's explanation of it, and therefore the term smoky god, referring to that sun as being something that they seldom see. And yet when you're entering from a polar opening, or at least approaching that, you get glimpses of that central sun or that source, and then it's very exciting to realize that there's, again, more support from what we're discovering for a hollow Earth theory than there is a solid Earth theory. And it's, to me, the more and more that we find out, the more exciting it becomes, and the more support and the more confidence I have that we don't know all there is to know about the interior of the Earth, and there's much more yet to be discovered.
Well, speaking of discovery, Earth explorers, I want you to go to the website. It's called The Source Part 1, TheSeed.com. The Source Part 1, TheSeed.com. We'll put a link up at x2-radio.com, X Squared Radio's website, so that you get to it and read a little bit about the book, about the author, about how it was developed. It's a highly interesting story. And it's one we're going to continue. We'll take a break here in about 4.5 minutes and rest your minds a little bit, get something to drink and relax a little bit. Because in the third hour, you know what we do notoriously. Here we go off a little bit beyond your imagination, but that's okay. You're going to be safe with us. Don't worry about it. Our phone lines are open. If you have any questions, it's 888-429-5471. I know many thousands of you sit out there and you write me these messages on Skype, or you send me emails, and I'm even getting text messages on my phone as we're on the air here. But don't be afraid to call. Believe me, we're just a couple of average guys with great ideas, but we'd be happy to share your thoughts. 888-429-5471 in North America. Anywhere else, whether you're on planet or even off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-9537. And those of you that are listening on our crystal clear digital conference line, 805-399-1000, you can listen, but you can't talk. By the way, if you have a Droid phone, we've made it even easier for you. I wrote a Droid app, which is at x2-radio.com. Go there, click on that, download it to your phone. You're one click away from listening to X Squared Radio. And if anybody can help me with the iPhone app, I've tried it several times, but I can't seem to get through the iPhone developer software and make it function. It just seems to be blocking me out. Something wrong with my certificate or something. But if you know how to do it, get a hold of me. I'd like to reach out to the Mac world too with that application. We're talking about the Hollow Earth, and yes, we are talking about a story, a novel called The Source. It's just part one of a trilogy, but it's substantial, folks. It's over 700 pages, and it's a book you don't want to put down, and you're so glad there's another page to turn when you're reading it, because the story's so good. And for those of you, there's about 40 million plus out there who have heard about the Hollow Earth that we have reached in one way or another over the last 6 years with this project. I want you to know that right now, live on Indiegogo.com, we have a crowdfunding project going. It's only a couple days old. You can be part of it. There's all kinds of goodies there. You can get free pay-per-view access. You can get a parka. You can even get access on the boat. You can go with us for the 15-day voyage. Go there. Even if you don't have any money to put into the project, you can still help. You can help by sticking that on your Facebook, on your Twitter, sending it to choice email contacts you might have. You never know who might want to really be a contributing enthusiast to this expedition. We need your help, and without you, it cannot be done. Don't forget, Indiegogo.com, put in the code words North Pole. It comes right up, no problem. You can be part of it. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with more with Norland Jacobs after this.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, now the streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light, it split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one dared disturb the sound of silence. Fools said, I do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words, like silent raindrops, fell. Echo. And the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. The character's name in the book is Mickey Urie. Yeah, you got to get this book, folks. My guest is Norland Jacobs, and we're talking about his book, The Source. Now, lots of people have asked me over the years, and I've been on a lot of radio interviews for this project, and I don't avoid the question, but I don't really answer the question as well as, you know, I really want to, because I'm, you know, I'm the scientist. I got to stick with the scientific point of view. I got to stay mainstream with this, or at least I believe the project's never gonna be a reality, at least the voyage to the Arctic Circle. But nevertheless, I do get asked the question, and I'm going to pose the question to Norland, and we're going to talk about it. And that is, you know, we've now at least opened your curiosity to the idea that earth might be hollow, that there may be significant voids in the earth. I can tell you as a scientist, absolutely irrefutably, without any doubt in my mind whatsoever, that if there is a void there, there will be life there. Now, it might be microbial, it might be more complex, like a fish or a barnacle or whatever, but it might also be much more than that. It might, in fact, be intelligent, in fact, highly intelligent. Ancients believed that the 10 tribes disappeared into the inner earth. Many ufologists believe that most of the UFOs that are now on the earth reside at the bottom of the sea. Seems like a perfectly logical place, perfectly safe from all prying eyes. We don't have anything that can creep around at 4,400 meters deep on a regular basis. But inside the planet, if it's possible that these craft or that ancient beings, off-world, ultra-dimensional beings could exist there, they will exist there. I can tell you that as a scientist. So let me ask you the question, Norlin. Smoky God, in that book, Olaf meets not only intelligent, but highly developed social beings. How do you address this in your book?
Well, we address it according to Olaf's experience, where he did in fact meet a highly advanced culture, related experiences that he had which demonstrated that, but this basically took place almost 200 years ago, according to Olaf's account, and so they would be even that much more advanced. But many things that go along with that, and there's many, many, many sources that I've gone to, apocryphal writings, scriptorial writings, prophetic, and then every culture has a reference to a paradisical place, whether it's Ultima Thule or whether it's Shangri-La or whether it's Shambhala or whether it's El Dorado, and the list basically goes on and on, that, you know, that there's a reference to this kind of paradisical place, references to a place that is continuous light. There's continuous light, that there is a kind of this paradisical terrarium type environment, you know, there that and that there's other references to a culture that is, again, very advanced. They live to be much older, 400 or 500 years of age, and based on that and those kinds of references and Olaf Jansson's experience, I approached the book that way, as far as Olaf telling his story, but he's telling his story in my book through his son, Jacob. And whereas Olaf is the father and Jacob is the son, and Jacob is still alive to tell his story to Mickey Urie. And that's what creates this great interest. Now, I don't want to reveal too much because I want to leave that for the reader to enjoy and get caught up in that. But basically, it talks about this highly advanced culture. But when you think of, okay, say we have our scientists, you know, and have had our scientists, if we'd have had Einstein instead of the amount of time that he lived, what if we'd have had him another 400 years? And Edison, and on and on and on with our great scientists and scientific minds. Imagine what they could have discovered. Imagine where they could have gone with their knowledge and as they progressed through their mathematics. And you look at that progression, you know, the Newtonian physics, which basically introduced physics, and then you go to the Einsteinian physics, which was considered to be the rebel against Newtonian physics and you know, was contrary to Newtonian physics. And then you go to quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and how that was considered for a long time, and not that long ago, 30 years ago, it was considered to be ridiculous and rebellious and fighting against Einsteinian physics, which is, you know, the E equals MC squared and so on and so forth. But now it's extremely credible, and it's taught in practically, I mean, every university and in several high schools and such, where that approach to physics has really expanded the potential and the possibilities. And if you take that and you take that those theories, if you take observations that we have on the exterior of the Earth, and basically, like, for example, what we tag as UFOs, which are basically very advanced transports or probes or whatever the particular observation has been of these different kind of machinery or flying objects. And there has to be, to me, there has to be some truth to that. You can't have years and years of observations, of reports from thousands and thousands and thousands of reputable people who have described oftentimes similar things at far distances away and on and on and on, and the ufologists know, you know, that the weight of the evidence with that, the preponderance of that evidence is just overwhelming. And yes, they had Project Blue Book for a long time that would investigate it, and then you go into these other areas of discrediting it, you know, where they try to, it seemed like almost, you know, with ridiculous explanations of saying, well, it was mass hallucination, or it was ball electricity, you know, or all these other kinds of things to explain away something that isn't even what these people are talking about. And
well,
yet,
I mean, you're right, and a lot of the observers have been credible, but it goes back a long, long time, back to the
absolutely
15th century. We see UFOs recorded in paintings, and, you know, right now we own the skies, but back then we didn't have anything that could fly. They could fly with impunity. They just needed to stay out of the range of arrows. So, Norlin, we have a caller on the line, Roth from Sacramento. Welcome to the program. How are you? Roth,
Norlin was my mentor when I started out in radio years ago, and we've been out of touch for more than 3 years until I covered his book. And I'm really thrilled to hear an intelligent conversation on the Hollow Earth theory. I was really into this, even way back there then when I knew you, Norlin, but I didn't know Norlin did this sort of thing, too.
I think this is Rock,
and
right?
I almost forgot.
Yeah, it's Rock.
It is. And I plumb forgot the question I called to ask about, but I haven't been reading much about this stuff for some time. But it has occurred to me that there's a lot more sonar discoveries made. And I, like you said, I think this CAT scan of the Earth, this is something new to me. So what else has there been? I was a little late for the show. I missed the first hour, so you might have discussed this. But are there has there been any sonar testing or anything that would give us any further information than I've seen in the past 20 years or so? Validate the theories. The Earth is hollow.
Most sonar is done by the military, and I'm sure they publish everything they discover. But, you know, accurate sonar imaging of the floor can only be done from about 300, 400 feet off the bottom. And these are 4,400 meter deep seas. They use a method called side scan sonar, and they can actually get a, you know, really accurate topology of the bottom if they do this. But it has been done that deep. It's been done off the coast of Cuba. But mind you, you only get a scan of about 300 or 400 feet wide. So you have to sail back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and stitch them together a lot like you would a satellite taking pictures on the moon to get, you know, accurate topology. And it's very expensive, very time consuming. And in these seas, it would be very treacherous to do. So we don't really have accurate bottom topology using sonar, that is to say sound waves in the water. And besides, this is the breeding grounds for whales. So you don't want to be pinging, you know, high amplitude sound waves in the water in the breeding grounds of where the whales go. So we're kind of in the dark when it comes to what does the bottom of the sea look like. These CAT scans using earthquakes and seismometers around the planet since about oh, what would you say, Norlin, 1995, 1996, they've kind of been linked together with high-speed internet cables, and they've been able to tie the vibrations together to get better and better imagery of the planet. So it's kind of a young science, and the information that they're getting really flies in the face of classic planetary core geology.
Yeah. Well, maybe...
I've read many accounts in the past of how some expeditions, the closer they get to the pole, the warmer the water gets, and tropical plants and flora and fauna have been found floating in the water. I wonder if there's anything in recent years along those lines, any recent discoveries.
There may be one aspect, and I think what you're looking for is what's new. What's new that we've discovered out there? Because those kinds of discoveries have been around for a long time, or those records and those references, you know, to warmer polar areas. The Russian scientists talked about the Lomonosov Ridge, you know, where the ocean seemed to be shallower on this particular arc of 1,500 miles in the poles and those kinds of things. So there's those kinds of things that are available to us that we can reflect back on and such that all give an indication that and you know, having equipment that doesn't work in the polar areas and things like that show that there's something different going on. But maybe something that you might be interested in that you don't know about, Rock and other listeners, is the more recent discovery of the plasma fountains that are erupting out of the polar openings, or at least from the polar areas of the Earth. Now, these plasma fountains, from what I understand, and of course, Brooks, you can, you know, probably elaborate on this, is that they erupt some 1,000 feet into the atmosphere. They're radioactive plasma fountains, and they basically dissipate and create the radioactive Van Allen belt. Well, I address that in the book, it's discussed, and I've come up with the answer for it, basically. I mean, it's presented in the book, and it's a reveal, and it seems to be something that I've been given the gift of the puzzle pieces of putting it together, like we've talked about, as far as, you know, having these different items, and these items come to us, and then we put the puzzle pieces together, and without dismissing them, we try and come up with a conclusion. It's like putting any puzzle together, which I've done my whole life. And if a puzzle piece doesn't fit, you don't take a pair of scissors out and cut it to fit what you want, because eventually it's got to fit somewhere. So you have to take all of the pieces, and you can't just take part of them to come up with the full picture. So it's interesting what science is trying to say or explain these plasma fountains, because they seem to be erupting out of the polar areas significantly. 1,000 feet into the air is rather significant. And yet they are coming up with explanations like, well, it's a fold in the atmosphere, and that's what's causing this. And ridiculous explanations, because they have no concept of the hollow Earth, which could, in fact, be part of the answer as to how this can be taking place. And again, I address that in the book and put it together.
I agree with your assertion that there seems to be more evidence that the Earth is hollow than that there is that the Earth isn't hollow. It's just simply that so many mainstream scientists want to dismiss it without hearing about it. That's unfortunate. I'm looking forward to reading your book, Norlin. I think that, as you know, I bought it. I read a few pages, but right now I'm spending all my waking hours doing research on Emanuel Velikovsky, and I think you know who he is. If you're
Earth in collision, Earth in upheaval, yes.
Yep.
Yeah, right. So, you know, he writes something up on plasma, too, and I'm wondering if you think the plasma is related to the aurora borealis. Is that the same thing, or is it similar, or coming out of the same hole?
Well, I know NASA and JPL have both been really excited about that, in the sense that they have spent a lot of money building satellites, the Themis probe and other activities that they've been doing, trying to figure out why it is that this intense, and some of it is plasma. Plasma is a gas that conducts electricity. And this electrojet that seems to be parallel to the flux lines that are coming out of the top and the bottom of the Earth, like it would any magnet, drives these high energy particles out to form the first layer of the Van Allen radiation belts, and the energy out to form the second layer of the Van Allen radiation belts. And it seems to sort of line up with solar flares, but not exactly. Sometimes we correlate it with the solar wind, we correlate it with solar flares, but sometimes the auroras, both the Borealis and the southern one, seem to occur on their own without a solar wind and without a solar flare or solar explosion. And that's what's really got them puzzled. So it's obvious that high energy particles and energy are coming out of the inside of the planet up what would kind of confusingly be through the crust, unless there was a hole or a very thin window. A window, when we talk about nuclear penetration, aluminum would be a good window. It would kind of pass right through there like it does cheesecloth. But it doesn't pass through iron and lead and solid limestone and like that very well. So for there to be a window for high energy particles and energy to come out of the planet and go zipping up into the Van Allen radiation belts, it would have to be a very thin window or hole. And that's what's got them excited, to be sure.
Well, before they were trying to explain it, that the Van Allen belt was capturing this radiation from the sun's rays and such, and that kind of lost credence in the fact that, the plasma has a limited lifespan and such. But then there's also photographs. There's footage of elapsed time or whatever of the Aurora Australis, where it shows the imminence of these lights is emanating and it's erupting and it's coming out of one particular area that's creating the Aurora Australis. And then like the same with the Aurora Borealis, the northern lights, like the southern lights, we have footage of this now. This is some of the kind of information that's becoming available to us that's sitting there saying, hey, wait a minute. If you look at a time-lapse photography or a video that's you speed up or something, you can see that these northern and southern lights are moving away from the Earth. They're coming out. They're pulsing away from the Earth. They're not being captured by a solar flare and emanating or filtering down through the Earth, but rather, in fact, they're also part of some kind of an eruption or an expulsion process. And it's fascinating to watch these. It's fascinating to see them, and then you kind of go, whoa, you know, you can see right where it's coming from. So, again, those are the kinds of things that are available to us today.
Well, Norlin, you're saying that the conventional wisdom has always been that the Aurora Borealis was coming from space down to Earth?
Well, it's one of the arguments that they've had, descriptions or explanations.
Never seems sensible to me, because when you see the Aurora Borealis, it does seem to be coming up from the North Pole. Well, anyway, guys, I'm grateful that you've reignited my interest in this field again. I've been interested in this probably since I was a teenager, and I'm really glad to see that there's more being done on it. And nice looking book, Norlin. Looking forward to reading it, like I said. So.
Some people you can use it for workouts too. You know, just do curls with it.
It's heavy. I told my wife, I don't want to fall asleep with this on my chest. It might crush me. All right, guys. Take care now.
All right.
Well, thanks, Rock. And hopefully it's a page-turner, you know, so that it doesn't become a burden, you know, but rather excitement. And like you were saying, that's the response that I've had before, Brooks, is that it's a page-turner and you're excited about every page. And there's actually 811. Sorry, but it's...
Well, that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that it's quite, you know, it's a page-turner, so I'm looking forward to it. Like I said, right now I'm doing a lot of research for my blog, so I haven't had a chance to pick that up, but that's next. Your book is on the top of the pile there.
Well, right, happy reading.
Appreciate the call, Ross.
Bye-bye.
You know, I found it interesting that, you know, somewhere in there he said, I've been thinking about this since I was a teenager. I can't tell you how many thousands of people have written me, have come up to me after lectures and have said, you know, almost with tears in their eyes, I've been thinking about this since I was a kid. You know, I don't really fascinate about planetary core geology. I don't think about hollow planets. I mean, I got enough things to worry about, you know, making a paycheck every Friday. But for some reason, even though people have the same worries, you know, trying to get through a mortal life, if you can do that as a human, you've really done something. But to have these dreams, these visions, these kind of out-of-body experiences where you're, you know, experiencing an inner planet, that I doubt you're resonating with a giant iron crystal inside the planet. In Norland's book, these societies, this sociology that exists inside the planet. Yes, it's a little bit like, you know, Chewbacca saying something in Chewbacca language and Han Solo answering back in English. I don't care what it smells like. Get your butt down in there. This is all, and almost starts out like a telepathic experience, but then evolves into an actual language experience. That's what you would expect, that beings that were that intelligent, that could live down there and stay hidden from all the military conquests that we have made as a society, and now we've claimed the airspace going all the way out as far as we can see into the galaxy. Anything that flies into our airspace belongs to the United States Air Force. Let's put it that way. I'm sure they're not happy with other ships flying with impunity above our sovereign airspace. And I would probably think that they would be just as uncomfortable with other water ships sailing or flying underneath the sea in their sovereign sea space. But that's exactly what's happening. It happens every day, and it's not a small percentage of the planet. It's a majority of the planet. Worldwide, more than 67% of people report having either seen one or having a firm belief that they exist. That's not a rumor, folks. That's not, that is mainstream. If you can get 67% of the people convinced that something is real, buddy, it's real. Well,
yes, and unfortunately, that challenges their superiority and their claimed authority over these things. And so it's easier for them to deny that it exists than to concede their inferiority to these evidently machines and such that are so far superior and advanced. So it's much easier. But then you have things like Area 51 and the Roswell incident and these kinds of things that that start out revealing too much, and then it takes a lot of backpedaling and then denying that it even exists, but then you can't hide from the satellite photographs and so on and so forth. I mean, at some point there has to be an acknowledgement that, okay, it's there for a reason, something is going on, and as slowly but surely information starts creeping out and becoming available and people reveal things and so on and so forth, they have to acknowledge, okay, yes, it's there, but we can't tell you what's going on there, or we'll have to kill you. So, I mean, it's kind of that kind of cloak-and-dagger approach to things.
They really reveal the information in the form of science fiction and say, oh, yeah, sure, we'll release another movie about another brain-eating alien, and that will keep you at least believing that it's all fantasy.
Yeah, we'll keep you at bay, and we don't want you to discover an inner Earth. And I kind of addressed some of that in the book also. And there is an opposition in all things, and in dramatic presentations there needs to be an antagonist, and there's an antagonist in the book, and it's it might be too familiar, but I think you've experienced some of, at least in possibility of some of those. I mean, that there are those who do not want this expedition to take place, let's put it that way. But they, I don't think they can fight it. I mean, you can't fight it. There's too many people that are aware of it. There's too many people that are excited about it. There's too many people that are looking forward to it. And at this point, it's a hot potato, I believe. And I believe, like we've shared, that that this is going to happen. because it's meant to happen. The timing is right. The time's right. The information there is available. And it needs to happen because you can't keep a lid on the progress of mankind forever. And at some point, there has to be a Columbus that, you know, discovers another country and discovers that the world is round instead of flat. And I know that's a, you know, kind of a redundant comparison, but that's what's going on. That's what's happening. This information is there. It's available. And we're in a world of information. You can go online and you can discover any of these things for yourself. And I think that's another, you know, why I wanted to do the book and subsequently the movie is because of to be able to present it in an entertaining and fascinating and fun and visual kind of a way that people can, again, like Rock was saying, get re-excited about it if they were, you know, thinking about it or been presented to them in their youth and then life got in the way and they haven't been able to think much about it since. And we've all experienced lulls in that in ourselves, and I'm sure you have too, Brooks, but it's that rekindling and reintroduction and doing it in such a way that hopefully, and I wanted this book to be informative enough and yet entertaining enough that it might just really kick off that awareness. Because like we were saying, you know, about the interior of the earth and the people there, is this the source of flying saucers? Well, it seems to be from an advanced civilization. A lot of people want to assign it to an alien or, you know, some external source from the earth, but that's only because they don't realize that there's quite possibly a civilization that has that intelligence and is that much advanced that they can, in fact, be responsible for them. And then all the other things that go along with it, you know, the science and the knowledge and the advancements that they might have that we talk about in the book about the potential. And then people look at it and, you know, and it's not the Atlantean, like you said, or the Lemurian, you know, reflection, but yet maybe there was something to that too. I mean, they describe it, they talk about it. Homer, you know, I mean, it's presented in such a way that these things existed. But like you said, it's been so fictionalized and fantasized and it applies to everything. I mean, every discovery, everything, every mystery and all that kind of stuff comes back to Atlantis. And so as a result, it gets kind of washed, you know, a little thinned out, you know, and it's not as exciting as the reality of it would be, of the possibility. So, yes, we address it in the book as there being an advanced civilization and based on Olaf Janssen's experience with it, plus a lot of other scientific things that kind of allude to many other things, we explore and use a little creative license and get in the ideas. But everything is theoretically feasible or possible, and that's how I've approached it so that it can maintain that interest and that excitement.
Well, and you're exactly right. I mean, last year we had the movie Cowboys and Aliens come out, and you know, you had the idea of reptilians coming to Earth and harvesting gold and doing crazy medical experiments on unsuspecting Earthlings. It was fiction. It was fiction. Harrison Ford shoot 'em up fiction, but it took themes that we have, you know, factual evidence from various ancient civilizations that this kind of, you know, nefarious activity took place. So we don't make a documentary and say this kind of, you know, information and activity took place. That belongs on Discovery Channel or History Channel. No, we'll make a movie about it and we'll put, you know, James Bond and Harrison Ford in the movie and it'll be fun. And that's exactly what they did. But people left that movie rubbing their chin going, you know, a lot of that seems to fit.
Yeah, and you also have Fire in the Sky, which was the movie of supposedly an alien abduction. To this day, everyone involved in that still claims to be absolutely true. And that, in a sense, is maybe even scarier than the scary movies, you know, the fictional accounts and such, only in the sense that, okay, if this really happened, then why aren't we giving it more credibility? Why aren't we giving it more credence? Why aren't we investigating it? Why aren't we trying to find out the cause of these things. And to me, that applies to thousands of observations and experiences and such. You take your commercial airline pilots. They won't even, if they have an encounter or they see something, which happens, I guess, daily, they don't want to even talk about it because the negative connotation that that has on their reputation, their record, their flight, you know, whatever it may happen to be, they don't even want to deal with it anymore because it's put into this category of fantasy or craziness or whatever. And I think that's intentional also. How can you ignore, like you said, ignore the facts, the obvious observations, if it wasn't for an intentional purpose? And so there must be an intentional purpose to that. There must be an intent behind it and a force behind it and an effort behind it. And that can create an antagonistic attitude towards a hollow earth theory or a hollow earth concept. But I think it's out of control. I think it's beyond that. And I think what a movie will do is when this comes out and it's just, you know, everywhere, and people are talking about the theory and they're talking about the concept, the more we talk about it, the more we're going to learn, the more we can compare notes, and the more excited we can get about the topic and about the, hopefully, maybe someday the reality of it.
Not only that, Norlin, not only that, but you know those movies that start out with, you know, some kind of John Williams-y kind of music that just kind of grabs your heartstrings. And before the title comes up, it says, based on a true story.
Yeah.
That's when people say, wait a minute, what do you mean based on a true story? This movie's about the hollow earth. How can it be based on a true story? And it is, and that's what will really change everything. And if we are able to pull off this expedition, if we actually get this ship and we leave Murmansk, Russia, we head up to Helsinki, Finland, take a 1 or 2 day break, and then off into the frontier we go. This is an area that's never been sailed before. It's been flown over. We already know that. And maybe the military has sailed or, you know, taken submarines underneath this ice before. But these are deep in Russian waters. And this area was covered by ice for a long, long time. It wasn't until 2007 when the jet stream seemed to mysteriously reroute. And by the way, it's been doing that more and more since 2007. The jet stream is a very fast moving a river of water that goes around our planet. Normally it dips down into Canada, takes that, you know, Arctic air, blows it across Canada, down into the Midwest, across Lake Michigan, and covers up Cleveland and Buffalo with snow. But that jet stream has been moving of late. And in 2007, it blew across the ice shelf so hard that the side shear was so strong and so cumulative that a continent-sized piece of ice broke off. We call it calving, like, you know, a cow having a calf. We call it calving. This calved off, and it was about the size of the state of Connecticut. It made the news, and it floated off into the Gulf Stream. Ever since 2007, this Northwest Passage has been open, but there's only two ships that are capable of actually sailing it, and that happens to be these two nuclear-powered icebreakers that used to belong to the Soviets and now belong to the Russians. We're taking one of those ships. We will be the first civilians to ever see this area of the ocean, let alone film it. Now, we might see whales and ice, and that's it. But then again, we might not. And I would say that if our imagination and our intention and our openness is there, we're liable to see anything. And that's my scientific curiosity. And I'm sticking with it.
And I'm enthusiastically supportive of that. And in fact, this might be a surprise to you. Well, I'm sure it's going to be a surprise to you. But I believe in it so much, and I'm so enthusiastic about it. I'm making this commitment to you right now over the air that I am committing $1 out of each book sold is going to the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.
Oh,
and that can hopefully generate and spark an interest of other people to be able to support it. If they don't want to just support it outright, they can buy the book, and they are supporting it. And I think that it can help generate and create those funds to be able to, I mean, the more interest that we can develop and they can buy up this book, because there's so many similarities, oddly so, not even coincidentally so, between the book and the actual expedition and actually what's taking place, it's kind of exciting. And when you said, this is Mickey Urie, you know, it was just kind of a fun little comparison there, and exactly along the lines that it seems kind of odd, but yet at the same time not odd at all. It seems kind of like kismet, kind of like the meant to be, that here we are, somebody that's experiencing that and going through this actual experience that we fictionally refer to or talk about in the book, but at the same time, the many, many things that are in the book that are factual that people are going to get so caught up and excited about that they've never heard about, whether it's the Coral Castle, whether it's the Hurling of Stones, whether it's the all the other things that are covered in it that are mentioned or presented or that we come across with this character, this individual, this radio DJ who comes across an interview and interviews all these people on the very kind of topics that you talk about on your show. And then that just kind of explodes into the roller coaster ride, it's been explained, of the storyline of that people can get caught up in and still at the same time learn about the Hollow Earth, or at least the projections of what's possible as a result of the puzzle pieces and putting those puzzle pieces together. So I want to make that commitment to you and hope that we can sell 10 million books, and wouldn't that be fascinating? Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be fun. Out. Know this, in about 4 hours, George Norrie is going to start his on-the-air celebration of his 10th year anniversary with Coast to Coast AM. I have been invited to that celebration on the air. So he's going to be calling me here at my studio in an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains in about 4 hours. And I'm sure, because one of George's favorite subjects that we talk about, yes, we do talk about electric cars from time to time, but his favorite is the Hollow Earth. And I'm going to mention on George Norrie's show tonight, Norlin Jacobs' book, The Source. And I'm going to try to get that link. I've already got a link on Coast to Coast AM tonight for xsquaredradio.com. And on that is a link to Norlin's book. But we're going to try and push the book tonight. If he'll give me 6 minutes or 8 minutes to talk for his celebration, I'm going to plug the book. 20 million people are going to hear it. Amazon, create space. Get ready to run the presses.
Sounds exciting.
It's going to be fun, and it's been fun having you on the program tonight. I can't believe we're almost done with our three-hour program. It seems to go so fast when we're having fun like this. Sometimes we don't get a lot of callers, even though there are a lot of people listening live tonight, because people just want to hear what's going on. They want to hear what we're talking about. They don't want to interrupt us. So we have this intelligent race that we're talking about. We got about 10 minutes left. I want to get this in so we don't get away from it. It isn't necessarily in conflict with the surface dwellers, but it is more or less in segregation from the surface dwellers. The under the world people don't have a large colony that lives on the surface of the planet, and they like it that way. But somehow Olaf and his son have made their way down into this area, and they have been more or less received with open arms, have they not?
According to Olaf's account, yes.
And they've been exposed to not only advanced technology, which I think is advanced to the point that it makes life more simple and more elegant, more beautiful, rather than complex and where, like a bad movie, where the technology overcomes the actual wisdom to use it. It seems to have reached a balance because of the stable longevity of the society itself, right?
Well, and I address that in the book, yes, where we talk about that, and we talk about what that kind of, you know, euphoric, you know, relationship or civilization could, how it could be conducting itself, because they've outgrown a lot of the pettiness that we have on the exterior of the Earth, and competitiveness and those things that it entails. And it, those things are addressed in the book, maybe kind of sadly, as to take a look at ourselves. But most people that have talked to me about the book is they say that they may not be avid readers or whatever, but they read this book and they might be involved with other things. And somebody will ask them, well, why are you reading this book instead of these other things? And they go, because it makes me feel good. And that's their response. It makes them feel good because of the potential that it's showing that mankind has. Like you said, that positive approach to life, that positive approach to the problems that we have, that there can be a better way. And we have to advance to a certain point to be able to achieve that and get that way. And that means we have to have a kind of a different basis of thinking. And our thought has to be one of more of compatibility than competitiveness. And
hopefully so that view is not post-apocalyptic. Hopefully we can do that before we start pressing red buttons all over the planet. Norlin, we have another phone call. LJ from Seattle, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I've been listening, very fascinated by the topic. I haven't heard you talk a lot about the why of the I guess you'd call it the naysayers. You have intelligent, scientific people who, in the face of all this evidence, still deny it or try to change it. But why? Do you really think it's a conspiracy, or is it more the you know, popular peer pressure type? And I'll take your answer over the radio.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, thanks, LJ. There are actually two levels of answers. I'll take the scientific side, which is that, you know, we kind of have a religiosity to our science. I hate to say it, but we do. We have a way of saying, I'm right, you're wrong. I've done my PhD on this subject, and I know more about it than anybody else. And I could tell you it goes back a long way. It's almost a tradition in our science. And sadly, we have had brilliant physicists and mathematicians actually commit suicide, actually take their own lives because they are so heartbroken after making their presentations before peer review. And the peers would stand up and excoriate those mathematicians and physicists so poorly, so badly, that those men would go home and take their own lives. And for some reason, it's been that way for 1,000 years in our science, and it is no different today. That's the scientific take. How about you, Norlin?
Well, on the scientific end, also, I address that in the book, and it's discussed and it's talked about, that, again, it's that, that, like you said, that peer pressure of defending the religion that this has become, you know, that their belief system has become. And they are continually trying to fit all the facts and all the observations into their theory that they have dedicated their lives to. And so they defend that, like you said, to the point of vilifying someone who suggests a different idea. Einstein was vilified before he was, you know, honored and elevated.
Oh, Galileo.
So it's just it's sad that that has to be the scientific process and such. But looking at it maybe from the dramatic point and talking about the antagonist, that there might be an effort to influence those who are trying to discover and advance the discovery of mankind, because they might have reasons to want to keep these things secret or hidden or unavailable, you know, to the masses, because either they know better or because of the chaos or the panic that it might bring forth. And again, that's also addressed in the book through the characters and through the discoveries that they have through the process and the development of the story. Again, it's very story-oriented. It's very fast-moving and exciting. It's action-adventure. But it it talks about it in such a way, and it deals with it, and it lives with it. It doesn't just like discuss it or present it like that. It's incorporated and infused into the storyline that appeals are made for the modern physicists, the new physicists, those people that are branching out and coming out, and yes, they had to endure and go through academia and the world, you know, of academics requiring them to learn certain things and recite different things and believe in certain things and report accordingly and such, but to branch out and to start looking at the facts that are out there and that are available and to start putting the pieces together like you've done of saying there might be more to this than meets the eye, or this needs to be investigated and these things need to be discovered. And like your expedition is very scientifically oriented to be able to generate scientific facts that support it or refute the negativism toward the possibilities, and just sit there and say, but how can you deny this? Here's the facts. How can you deny that? What's the cause of this? What's the cause of that?
I'm not
the scientific person. I put the puzzle pieces together, and I try and do it dramatically and entertainingly. So I think there's many aspects that are possible.
Like LJ was asserting, though, that you have a credible academic scientific community that's being naysayers. They're saying this is nuts. It's crazy. Everyone knows we live on this giant molten ball. But there's also, because there's an establishment viewpoint of how the planet's put together, and it gives them credibility and peace in their lives as long as that is maintained. But
today, and authority.
Today there are more out-of-work physicists or cross-employed physicists than there ever have been before. It's a fascinating subject, and a lot of people take it, but realize, you know, it's sort of like having a degree in music. You're not going to make a really good living with it, and you need a really good living these days to enjoy the niceties of life. And, you know, simply knowing the language or the relationship between math and physical things is not enough to make a living anymore. So you're going to end up working in aviation, or you're going to work in, maybe energy efficient buildings, or like I do, in electric vehicles. You're going to apply that physics in some way to actually make a living, or you're going to be stuck in academia. And if you're stuck in academia, I'm sorry to say you're being left behind, because the internet, you know, say what you will about it, is blasting position papers and abstracts and patents out at a much faster rate than the affiliated community is doing. Why? Because we don't have to go through the peer review process. We put our ideas out there and let the world build them, take them apart and put them back together. And that's the real world. That's how it's put together. We don't have to go through the high priests of the PhD in order to get our ideas out there. We simply just put them out. And it's changing. It's changing the whole fabric of everything, but it's also, you know, creating an instability. And I think that can be a little bit dangerous on all levels, not just scientific, but also political. You know, we have thought for a long, long time that the, quote, powers that be, the presidents, the czars, the prime ministers, the Bilderbergs, were in charge of everything. Now, come on, we thought that. But now we've realized that the Bilderbergs have lost their grip on everything, that money isn't doing exactly what they thought it was going to do. So they're having to print more in order to stabilize it until they're able to, you know, get out of the stock market themselves. Come on, people, just watch what Warren Buffett has been doing the last few weeks, pulling his money out of dollar store. Get real. That's just the stock they're noticing. Every billionaire is pulling his money out of the stock market. Why? Because they need to be in a cash position when this thing falls apart. And it's going to fall apart.
Well, when they continue to try and maintain the status quo and they don't allow that progress, like you said, with the physicists that are out of work, if there isn't a field or an area or an aggressive attack to new thought and new thinking and new discoveries, then there won't, and if that's not supported, then there won't be work for physicists who are exploratory and trying to discover these things, because we'd rather maintain the status quo, because those who are in charge and have the control over the status quo, they're the ones who feel comfortable and want it to remain as such. And so you get into this kind of catatonic state of progress, and like you said, that makes things fall apart, because if you're not moving forward, you're falling behind.
Yeah.
And we're kind of politically, like you said, falling behind. There's political reasons why discoveries aren't being made or aren't being acknowledged, and the pieces aren't being put together, is because there's an effort to prevent those pieces from being put together, because that would demand progress. And there are those who don't want progress because they are comfortable and want to maintain the status quo.
That's very true. And you know, watch what's happening with states of people who realize that there aren't jobs to be had. If you can't get a job, you'll create a job for yourself. Look at two states. Look at Utah and look at North Carolina. They're the two highest states in the nation with single location businesses. Do you know what that means? That means that an entrepreneur could not get a job or lost a job, and rather than move away from his home to Georgia or to California or to Texas, Texas is booming with jobs, they stay home and they create a job. And that's where these small businesses are coming from. They're coming from necessity, and they're also coming from a great desire to succeed. And that's why these people are doing what they're doing. That's force that's driving science right now.
Well, and again, and in the book, we bring those things out. We bring those conflicts out. We bring them out in a sense that maybe that's why we don't have that euphoric or that civilization or that type of community that can live in that peaceful kind of paradisical experience, because there are those elements of the surface mankind that, whether it's greed or aggression or power and those kinds of things that they're pursuing and chasing after. And like you said, hopefully it's not going to require something catastrophic to bring people to the realization that that's probably the wrong way to go. And that's why people who have read the book have said, it makes me feel better. It gives me more hope and more realization that mankind can actually live in this peaceful kind of world, and it can be on the surface of the earth as well as on an imagined, hopefully a realistic, you know, civilization that's actually there, that's responsible for these things that we've observed and haven't come up with the answer with, and yet it's got to be coming from somewhere. These things got to be coming from somewhere. And why not from some place where they live peacefully enough that they can handle these kinds of inventions and knowledge and mechanisms and technology. And so here we are with all of these things facing us, and all these potentials. And like you said, physicists that are committing suicide because no one is willing to listen, and they would rather berate somebody and vilify them for thinking out of the box rather than being excited and thrilled and wanting to pursue their thinking process because of the potential that it has. So if you can feel better about reading about the potential that we have, that's, I think, innate in every human being, that every human being has that positive seed, that positive source in them, that they can be, and uniformly and together, turn these things around and this kind of thinking around, that potential is there. And people read the book and they go, wow, if anybody's going there, sign me up. I want to be there. I want to go with them.
That's the kind of woman you want to fall in love with. That's the kind of employer for whom you want to work. And that's the kind of book you want to read. The Source by Norlin Jacobs. Norlin, thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio. We are completely out of time. I can't believe it's gone that fast. Thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go ahead and close it out, folks. It's January 6th. We'll be back on the 13th. Don't go away. Keep us on your favorites. We'll be back next week with more X Squared Radio.